with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome aboard. Oh, that was a tough hour. And I'm going to try to move past it.
So, everybody in the chat room. Yeah, Bob got all the buttons right tonight. Thanks, Cobwebs. We do appreciate your faith.
Oh, I almost screwed up, though, because I had my monitors up, and I heard the microphone getting ready to go, woo. I need a keeper. I need a staff. But you know what? We're going to get through this. We're going to have another fine, fine evening. It's New Year's Eve. 2008. Is almost mercifully done. 5 hours and 58 minutes remaining of it here in the Eastern time zone. And it's already New Year's on the European continent. And gosh, it's sometime tomorrow where John Fox is down in Sydney. Down in Sydney, up in Sydney, you know. It's also relative. But it is New Year's Eve. It's and again, it's another one of those artificial dates. There's no New Year's marker in space for the Earth to pass. This is something we do for ourselves. A chance to reflect and a chance to look forward. And I've got a lot on the plate tonight, something that I've been holding on to, a story to go into that I hope will make a little bit of sense. But it's Wednesday. It's not just the middle of the week. It's not just hump day. It's not the day before the holiday, because I will take tomorrow off and be a totally useless college football junkie. We won't do a bowl game show tonight, I promise, no matter how profoundly I'm tempted to do so. I won't do it. No. What it is prayer meeting. Choir master, please. Wrong button. I'm button cursed. Here's the right one, choir master. Anybody paying attention here?
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stuck a sermon on the mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest. keep me rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, glory, praise, brethren and sistren, shamalabading-dong, I love you. Come on down the blood-red carpet, the center aisle, to the altar, and lay your hands on the subwoofers and feel the rays of healing reason flowing through your body as you stand here in the magnificent cathedral of common sense. I am Archbishop Bob Kincaid, and this here is prayer meeting. Yes, indeed, it is. And a very, very special prayer meeting it is, as we face the end of this old year and the beginning of a new one. Amen and amen. Ha! And I want to go to our the Vatican has the Vatican's official astronomer, which I just find a complete contradiction in terms, knowing the history of the church. I watched Religious, Bill Maher's Religious. And he did an interview with the Vatican astronomer, or I guess maybe the guy was recently retired or something, but the guy was eminently sane, and just blew my doors off, and it just picked this priest, he just picked the bones of fundamentalism clean. I mean, there wasn't a greasy spot left when he was done with the fundies. And that was kind of cool. And so, the Vatican has its Vatican astronomer. Well, when we go to consider things calendrical, we have the Internet's most brilliant satirist. Yes, yes, yes. We have Eugene Finnerman of FinnermanWorks.com and Your RDA of Irony. And I just want to share with you what Eugene offered up today. Eugene sends along the following thoughts. He says, I'd wish you a happy 2009, but I'd be at least 4 years too late. Huh? What? What you talking about, Willis? According to the most charitable calculation, next year will be AD 2013. Okay, I'm getting confused. The mistake dates back to the early 6th century. Until then, even the church was using the pagan calendar. That chronology was based on the legendary founding of Rome. 753 BC, ab urbe condita, I do believe. As a cross-reference, it also cited the reign of the prevailing tyrant. Well, you know, you gotta give props. For example, if you check the Vatican archives, the notarized date for the Nicene Creed would read, in the 1078th year of Rome and in the 19th year of Constantine. Western civilization obviously needed, and that wasn't 1078 either. Good gracious sakes, that would be the hold on, I got to work my Roman numerals here. That would be M L X X V I I I th year of Rome, and in the X I X year of Constantine. Western civilization, I got button problems. Forgot to turn the ringer off. I'm kind of dippy that way sometimes.
But anyway, so that's what that would say. Western civilization, Eugene notes, obviously needed a shorter and less pagan date. So in the 1002, oh, do I have to do this again, Eugene? In the MCCLXXVIIIth year of Rome, otherwise known as 525 AD, the church finally converted its calendar. The new chronology, based upon the birth of Jesus, which they just sort of made up, that's my editorial comment, not Eugene's work. Not that they made up the birth of Jesus, but they made up the date of the birth of Jesus. They may have made up the birth of Jesus, but, you know, was calculated, and certainly made up a lot about the birth of Jesus, was calculated by a mathematical monk named Dionysius Exiguus. His mother just called him Donnie. Dionysius Exiguus. Dionysius is not the most trustworthy name for a mathematician or a monk. You know, Dionysus, Dionysius, god of wine and revels and the minads and the lopping and the killing and the drinking. In fairness, Eugene notes, however, the poor guy was doing division with Roman numerals. See? See? It is amazing that his chronology was wrong by only 4 years. The church apparently caught the error because Dionysius was not made a saint. It, however, never got around to correcting the mistake. The church seems to be quite ecumenical about arithmetic. Okay, ecumenical will do. I was going to use hard-headed, but you know, who the heck am I? Ironically, however, the Reformation never brought up the mistake either. You know, you would have thought that Martin Luther would have rubbed it in. The boisterous German described one pope as a syphilitic dung beetle, so he hardly would be shy about an accounting discrepancy. Yet on this subject, Luther was oddly discreet. Jean Calvin and John Knox were also surprisingly silent. Well, these are all religious guys. They're not real good with math, Eugene. I mean, I'm an archbishop, and I can barely balance a checkbook. You would expect them, he says, to wish you a dour but mathematically precise New Year. Happy New Year, and don't enjoy it. So apparently all of Christendom is going along on the cover-up. Eugene says, then so will I. I don't want to incite another 1,900 years of persecution. 2009 it is, and have a happy one. But if I read Eugene correctly, it would appear that what we're dealing with here is December the 31st, 2012. That's what this is. Okay? Now, jot that down if you must. December 31st, 2012. This has some meaning. It ain't a party till something gets broke, Agnes.
I didn't do anything. Yet.
She's already on the sauce. We go through this every New Year's. Anyway, we've got a problem. Or at least, well, some kinda. Because, and this is going to be a little bit confusing, but work with me here. I actually asked Eugene about this, but I didn't get a response. We've talked on this program on a number of occasions about the fact that the Mayan calendar calculates its end-of-the-world date as being somewhere around between December 22nd and December 24th, 2012. Oh, you see the problem now. Yes, 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 yes. Now, nobody ever consulted the Mayans, who had a far more accurate calendar than anything any saint, pope, monk or Caesar ever came up with, or anybody else for that matter. It's just about the most accurate calendar done by anybody in human history who didn't have the benefit of what we like to call modern mathematics and science. Shh, don't tell the church. They were using numbers with zeros, those crazy pagan Mayans. That's why they had to have a genocide committed against them. That's why they had to have all their books burned. And their calendars. That's why we were only able to recreate the Mayan, the Mayan syllabary. Well, not really syllabary, hieroglyphs. We only learned to read Mayan in the last 50 years or so. So while Eugene wants you to have a happy 2009, and I do too, I can't help noting that whole end of the world thing appears to have just gotten by us by about a week, which is kind of a bummer. I maintained this because to be at Chichen Itza on the winter solstice and see that snake, that shadow crawl down the snake on the shortest day of the year. You know, the Quetzalcoatl representation, the feathered serpent. That's got to be something to see. Now, I know, people like to stand at Stonehenge and what, or there's some sort of ancient burial in Ireland or somewhere where only on the solstice does the sun's rays, it illuminates a 30-meter shaft in a grave. And only on that day. And that's got to be cool. But leave it to the first peoples of this continent to come up with animation for their calendrical stuff. Because on the winter solstice, the sun strikes that snake, and the snake literally appears to come alive with the light. And I know there were a lot of people out there thinking, you know, I really want to be down there at Chichen Itza or one of the other Mayan pyramid temples. I want to be there on December 22nd, 23rd, or 24th, 2012. There's only one problem as far as I can tell, and I think I'm right. It just happened. Because based on what Eugene has said, we're kissing 2012 goodbye tonight. And so, oh well, there goes another harmonic convergence. What are you going to do? And it's tough. But I think about these things as I contemplate things like New Year's. And I tell you what, as far as 2008 is concerned, there is a lot to recommend taking the pages of the 2008 calendar, tearing them into tiny pieces. See, he forgot to turn the ringer off again. Tearing it into tiny pieces and taking it outside and burning that sucker at midnight. And we are certainly ending the year. A lot of people have a whole lot of hope for what will happen in 2009. I'm middle-aged, jaded, and cranky. So I'm not expecting any great change or so forth.
Middle-aged?
No, I'm middle-aged and cranky. You're young and beautiful.
Oh, God, I love you. And what? Now, don't count out the...
Dang, you smell birdie.
Don't count out the catastrophe yet, because you heard that Yellowstone was having some
problems. Talked about that a little bit last night. All kinds of earthquakes and tremors and so forth.
Yeah. So
it is Wednesday night and it is prayer meeting. So let's see, we got quaking of the earth.
Yeah.
We got a volcano cooking somewhere, and we have wars and rumors of wars.
And Bob will have his war tonight for calling me middle-aged and cranky.
I did not know I called me middle-aged and cranky. Dadgummit, woman.
Happy New Year's Eve, everyone.
And Happy New Year to you.
Love you guys.
And for heaven's sakes, honey, take the straw out of the champagne bottle, would you please?
I don't drink, Bob.
No, you don't drink.
But you're making me think it would be a wise choice if I did.
Woman's got a hollow leg, I'm telling you.
Yeah, that's why he married me.
See, it's just stumbling and staggering around. It's just kind of pathetic, really. But, it's the New Year's. And it wouldn't be New Year's without playing some sort of schmaltzy, shticky, gooey-ooey New Year's song. So Happy New Year's, everyone. I couldn't think of anything more schmaltzy and shticky than this. I love the sound of a nose flute. Coming.
She didn't recognize the
you know, I can sing like this if I've got helium handy.
Then her eyes flew open wide. She went to hug me and she spilled her purse. And we
and the myth.
We cried.
Nah, stop it, Bob. She spilled her purse and we laughed till we cried. What, she's on ecstasy? I mean, that ain't exactly funny, is it? Tell us more, Dan Fogelberg. Beats the hell out of shoplifting. Romance getting liquored up in the car. She took the bottle caps off with her teeth. No. Well, an architect can do that, building houses and all. Now, doubt her gratitude just a damn minute. I'm sorry. Is anybody bothered by that? Anyway.
Then I must be doing well. I said the audience was helping me, but the traveling was hell. We drank across the innocence. We drank across the now.
You know, just hearing that voice go up that high makes me feel like I'm getting a hernia. It really does.
Try to reach beyond the emptiness, but be the one who how. We drank across the innocence. We drank across the time.
Tom! I love you, man! And we don't want to know why. We do not want to know anything about tired tongues, okay? Just save it, Dan.
Running out of things to say.
Yeah, but how about stuff to sing? Hershey's.
And I watched her drive away. Just for a moment, I was back in school.
Hallucinating. We know what we call that old familiar pain when you're in college.
As I turn to make my way back home,
that often happens in automobiles.
Snow turned into rain.
Hugh Kenny G. Yeah, Flog that saxophone! More syrup! I'm not even sure that's a saxophone anymore. That might be a bagpipe being killed. Okay, so we've done our schlocky, syrupy thing, and we've gotten that out of our system, right? I mean, I don't have to do any more of that, right? Somebody help. I got to have some decent music to cleanse my palate with later. Yeah, I know. Your diabetes is acting up, Bonzo. What do you think's happening here? Oh, God. Yeah, and the email rolls in. Y'all are just about the most intolerant audience I think I've ever known. Yeah, there it is. Why are we playing this drivel? God! God! Yeah, that might be God. That's more like what it sounds like. And drivel it is indeed, beyond any shadow of a doubt. And we won't do it anymore. But, you know, there's some traditional radio stuff that just has to happen, and you just got to do it. I know, everybody wants a shower now. Ooh, now I'm all sticky, Yogi. I'll tell you what. You guys have got everything all lit up, so let's march through and see what happens.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Speaking of nose flute.
Yes.
I'd never heard of it until about a month ago, and I love to work the British crosswords, you know, the cryptics.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an answer I just could not get. I thought some kind of flute, but I couldn't figure out.
Yeah, nose is not one that you're going to put in front of flute with any regularity. No.
And so finally I just thought, well, I'll try that. And then I looked it up, you know, because you learn a lot from crosswords.
Sure.
But I found out, you know, that you can buy them or you can make them. And they come in all kind of things. But the... What was funny was you saying that the other day. I saw an interview of Maya Angelou.
Mm-hmm.
She says something about the nose flute. But anybody, how you get from find out about something and then you hear other people talking about it all the time, and probably they had said something, but you hadn't noticed it before. I know that's earth shattering, but it just kind of, I just thought it was kind of neat.
Absolutely.
<It's>, nose flute. It kind of made me want to have one.
Oh God, I can't. I dread what happens when you get impressed by a timpani.
By what?
By a big bass drum or a timpani or something. Kind of want one of those.
Oh. But it was just funny, you know. It just stood out to me, and then I heard like you two say something about it. Anyway, what was that year you were trying to figure out?
Well, no, I think we got it figured out. This is actually December 31st.
I was trying to write it down. You were saying
that. Yeah, this is December 31st, 2012, and tomorrow will actually be January the 1st, 2013.
I'm talking about the Roman numerals.
Oh, all the Roman numerals. Oh, golly, I closed.
I got MCC, LXX, V.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was 1278. So MCC.
I got
LXX V I I I.
Oh, three I's. Okay. Well, I had.
Yeah, because there was an eight there.
1277 with just the two I's. Yeah, I'm pretty good with Roman numerals. That's kind of.
I am too if I can see them, and I taught myself to be good at Roman numerals by being obsessive or compelled by the Roman numeral date at the bottom of movies. You know, because it's always, you know, copyright Amazon
Diversion. Teacher that taught this, and some reason, just hang on, you know, hung on to me.
Yeah, the 1278th year of Rome, which would be AD 525. Yeah, so M CCLXXVIII.
Okay. Okay, the reason I called was I finally realized what the one question I wanted to ask was, why do they call it global warming? Because the reason I ask is I've heard of this, you know, Isaac Asimov or whatever.
Asimov, yes.
He used to be on Merv Griffin talk show, and I saw him, and he talked about global warming way back then. And you know, then
well, the reason that it's global warming is because the release of the effect of the release of more and more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And the primary greenhouse gas being carbon dioxide, leads to an overall warming trend on the planet. And it is global in nature.
But when people see, you know, all the snow and all like that, then they just don't buy it. You know, a lot of people
idiotic little right-wingers say, "Why, cold outside? Thank goodness for global warming or we'd be even colder."
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard that a million times if I've heard it once.
I still think that it could be a better name, like pollution. I mean, it's pollution, and
but there's the debate over what, you know, calling it global climate change.
That still wouldn't.
But it is a global event. It's hard to get around that fact.
Well, it's global pollution. We're not the only polluters on the earth. We may be the worst, but we're not the only ones.
Right. Exactly.
But anyway, that was mine. I just think it should have a better name. I don't know.
Well, let us know when you come up with one.
Well, I mean, pollution. Pollution.
Yeah, but pollution takes in everything. This is atmospheric stuff that touches upon the profound earth-shattering.
Isn't it caused by pollution?
It is caused by pollution.
Yeah, and who's the polluter? It's us.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, just a little thing I was wondering about. And then I wanted to say something about Cynthia McKinney.
Yes.
Actually, Cynthia McKinney, a lot of people don't agree with me, but she's one of my heroes. I remember after the 2000 election, you know, she was in the Congress then. And she's stood up in Congress and spoke about the 2000 election being stolen away from Al Gore.
And that in Congress. That cost her her seat.
Yeah, I'm sure. And then she also, I think she was out, and then she came back and she talked about why George Bush should be impeached. And I just admire her.
Especially, you know, she put it on the line to try to get that humanitarian aid to the burgeoning genocide victims in the Gaza Strip, and of course for her pains and her troubles, she and the ship were attacked by the Israeli Navy.
Yeah. And actually,
but there's nothing new in that.
Right,
there's doctors, surgeons, medical supplies, nothing threatening, just stuff that might save lives. And of course, you don't want to be saving any lives.
Right.
Because this is a genocide in progress.
Yeah. And that your boss called in last night about that, about Joe.
Yeah, I did. I watched that, and that was
I watched it, too. But Joe Scarborough, well, I just throw away my newspapers, blah, blah, blah. You know more than all these experts all over the world.
Yeah, wasn't he, pardon my mouth, Juanita, wasn't he just a little bit pissy?
You know, I haven't liked him since I used to watch him on Bill Maher show.
Well, I haven't liked him since I realized that he may very well have gotten away with the murder of Lori Klausutis.
Well, that's been since then. You know, and you know, after that happened, he resigned. He had just been reelected to Congress, and he resigned after that.
Yeah.
Kind of mysterious, ain't it?
A little bit. But, you know, I guess Cynthia McKinney should be grateful. The last time the Israelis decided to attack a ship,
yeah,
it was the USS Liberty, and they killed a bunch of people.
I remember that, yeah. Well, I thought you were going to talk about that girl getting run over by the tractor.
Well, the bulldozer, yeah, right.
Yeah, peace worker. But and I also like you to tell Kate something.
Okay.
Maybe she.
Well, why don't you tell Kate something?
Okay, I was just gonna say I think she likes to eat healthy, and you can cook. I mean, almost any vegetables without all the other stuff in it. Now, for New Year's, our tradition down here was black-eyed peas and hog jowls.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got a little hunk of hog jowl in the refrigerator, too.
Yeah. But I quit doing that after a family tragedy that happened on New Year's while peas were being cooked. But you can cook like your peas. You can cook almost any vegetables. Now, a lot of Southerners not going to like it because they have to learn to like it. But once you learn to like just the vegetables, just cooked on their own,
mm-hmm.
with very little liquid, usually with their own liquid, if it's a good squash or whatever, you will just go out of your mind with the taste of it.
But I tell you what, getting a Southerner away from his or her bacon grease, them's fighting words, Juanita.
Oh, I know. I was raised on it.
But you know what? I've been very good since last May when my innards rebelled against me.
Uh-huh.
I have very seldom touched the delight of bacon grease. And that's doing something for me.
Yeah.
I've had my beloved Kaneka sausage once.
Yeah.
I don't think we've fried sausage here since May.
Well,
I'm trying. And you know, I had very good blood work back from the doctor. Yeah, my cholesterol is at 200, which is stupendous for me.
Yeah.
And all the enzymes are in all the right places.
Good.
With the single exception of my triglycerides.
Yeah.
Which are through the roof, and I think that's because I'm a triglyceride
factory.
Oh, well, no, my good cholesterol's way low and my bad cholesterol's way high, but it's
yeah.
But overall the cholesterol's low, but it's the triglycerides that are the problem.
Yeah. Oh, they're celebrating out here already. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that, Pop.
Yeah. But
jumping
anyway,
the gun.
Huh?
But you know, come midnight around here, Juanita, we'll hear a lot of banging and popping. Only thing is, it won't be fireworks. It won't be fireworks. It'll be people walking outside and putting a few rounds through the 12 gauge.
Oh, okay.
Or the 9mm pistol.
They could get out of trouble out here because we're close. We're a suburban area.
And by the way, Kate informs me that that is the way she eats her vegetables.
I figured it was, and I think she would agree. I was fortunate, I guess, to be married to a Yankee, and, you know, that's the way I learned to cook for him.
Okay.
And I learned to enjoy it myself.
Well, I have, Juanita, I need to run along. I've just been told that I've got an international phone call on the line, and I have to see if I can try to find out which one it is.
Happy New Year, everybody.
All right. Happy New Year, Juanita.
Yes.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, let's see if we can make this happen here. No. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. I'm not the international call.
Okay, well, I tell you what, Preston, can I put you back on hold and keep looking?
Sure thing.
Okay, stand by. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
I want to say, my laddie, that wasn't a bagpipe that was dying. It was a wee bit more awful than that, I can assure you.
What was getting killed?
I don't know, but I don't think it's alive anymore. This is Scott.
That's what I thought, Scott. How are you? Happy New Year already.
Hey, good New Year to all of my Svenska and Amerikanska vänner.
You do that R real pretty.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah, I love a rolled R.
I had to go to actual immigrant course to learn how to do that.
You mean, do you get certified? Do you get certified in R in Sweden or something?
Oh, I'm certified. That's all right. That's
I'm true. Certifiable, so, you know, we're going.
No, actually, when you told me, you do get to take a lessons. The state decides they want everybody to learn Swedish, so I do that. They do help you out with the R's if you need it.
And, you know, how nice the idea of state sponsored. You live in that socialist paradise over there, and the state-sponsored language? Wow. Over here, you know, you've just got Neil Bortz on the air screaming. No, or was it Liddy? I can't remember. I'm not going to teach my children to speak illegal alien.
You illegal alien. Yeah, well, so, we got it made over here, and I'm just hoping, against all hope, that our new president will take a little inspiration from the 20th century Europe and kind of bring America out of the 19th century and institute some of the same sort of things there.
It would be nice, and I will be thrilled to pieces if it happens. But you know as well as I do, Scott, that there will be a Confederacy of dunces arrayed against the idea.
Oh no, the right wing will just turn. They'll have apoplexy to stun the rest of it. Everything. Actually, it's going to be kind of fun to watch if we can keep our blood pressure down. When the right wing just totally flips out at everything, anything and everything that he wants to propose.
And, well, you know, I would really like to see. I'm willing to wait and sort of bide my time and keep my counsel a little bit, but I'd really just like to start watching. I mean, you know, if I turned on the television and Sean Hannity's head just exploded on air, it'd be a beautiful thing. And you know, I mean, they are losing their minds. Among other things, Scott, you know, I get these right-wing emails. And, one of the things I saw today was that, one of these outfits has released its free offer of the 2009 Sarah Palin calendar. And the cover of it has her in like a blue chambray shirt with a broken open, it looks to be an over under 12 gauge shotgun.
Stop, don't say anymore. You get all the right wing trolls all excited.
Yeah, I don't, we can't have that. No.
Hey, is there any truth that they're naming the new baby they got in that family Tweaker after the grandma?
No, well, you know what I heard? I was over at BartCop.com, and he had the link to the story of the birth of that baby. And he changed it just a little bit. He said, I fell apart. Every now and then, I have this weird little sense of humor, Scott, and every now and then things just fall apart on me. And I read the name that BartCop applied to this baby. And Agnes had to come check on me because I was.
Suspense is killing the audience here, though.
Yeah, let's see. Trip Keyshawn Flapjack Johnston. See, I just said it again.
That's a good one.
Trip Easton Mitchell Johnston. Trip. And
that's,
you got a gr- and you got and Trip and Granny's a Tweaker.
They named him Trip?
With two P's.
Oh, because I didn't, you know, I don't know how that crystal meth all works. I didn't know you can trip on it. I knew that, you know, LSD. You know,
well, but Granny, it turns out Granny's not a meth head. Granny's a downer junkie.
Ooh, downers in Alaska?
Oh, yeah. Well, Wasilla is not just the meth capital of Alaska. It also turns out to be the OxyContin capital of Alaska.
But I just mean philosophically, if you're up there in the cold, in the dark, why take a downer on top of all that?
You know, if I lived up there in the cold and the dark, yeah, if I lived up there in the cold and the dark, Scott, I couldn't drink a cup of coffee. I don't know how the Swedes do it.
We have better coffee.
Well, there is that, and you drink a darker roast, too, and that takes out some of the caffeine.
Yeah, but, well, we have the welfare state to you know that if we OD on the caffeine and the caffeine, whatever it's called, that, you know, we can get our blood thin for free, so we can get dialysis for the extra strong coffee.
Yeah, they've got it right next to the the coffee houses, don't they? You go and you load up on a few cups of extra thick and extra dark, and just go get thinned and then go on home in the dark.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
And what time is dark hitting you these days?
Oh, good grief! The sun goes under the horizon at 3:30 in the afternoon. Here, it's where I'm at. Further north, it's been down at the top of the country. They haven't seen the sun for well over a month. The polar circle goes through the country, sort of near the top.
How long did it, you came from the States. How long did it take you to get used to that?
Oh, I don't know, a few years. 4 or 5 years, I suppose. But the summer more than compensates for it.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Because you get up and you can, I discovered a long time ago that sometimes if you can get up at 4 in the morning on right around solstice, everybody's on vacation like doing on a Sunday, you can sometimes get outside and you don't hear a single motor or sound or a car tire swooshing, and you hear the planet as it was meant to be. The sun's up, you can hear insects and trees, and you can hear, practically hear geese paddling a half a mile away. It is the most amazing thing. So, you couldn't do that if everything was at work. So it's only because of this, midnight sun sort of thing, like 3 or 4 in the morning, you sometimes.
That's on my so-called bucket list. I want to see the midnight sun sometime.
Well, I've managed to do it once. We went way up north to, the top of Europe, up there in Norway, a place called Nordkapp. And, it's even in the middle of the summer, they got glaciers stuck in snow up there, but you get way, way up there in midnight sun, and it is spectacular, because it is virtually daylight for days and weeks on end.
That's got to be just amazing, because, see, I remember way back when I was just a young guy behind a microphone. At CNN, there was a job posting for people who wanted to go to work in the Moscow Bureau. And one of the things that was said was that, you had to pass a battery of psychological tests before you could be considered for the job.
Because of the darkness.
Because of the cold and the dark. And I guess it was considered an occupational hazard that you'd go over there and, get halfway through winter and just, dance right off the straight back chair and have done with it.
Oh, excuse me for laughing, but that, to me, sounds like a complete and utter absurdity. Living here, that's just like daily reality. So, it could mean that we're all nuts. Maybe CNN got it right, and Scandinavians are all loony as can be, but I don't think that would be necessary, really.
Kate wants to know if you can hear the Northern Lights and the ice sing.
Not easily. It has to be awfully damn quiet to hear some sort of a. I've seen the Northern Lights a few times, but that's really more of a. The few times I've seen it, there's too much else going on. Now, you've been on city street, out where I live, you can hear cars going on. So my answer would be no, but that doesn't rule out that it does happen.
Well, so let's have our little cultural moment, Scott. Is there big doings for New Year's Eve there?
Oh, everybody with disposable income who loves big bangs and booms goes out and buys some real sky rockets. They do some ones that get this sound, and you hear quiet, and then it's bang up in the sky. They sell some monster fireworks to the public here.
Yeah. Oh, well, you mean like the kind that if you shot one off in Gaza, they'd send a helicopter and blow you away?
Maybe.
Just about.
Yeah. No, but they got some huge ones to go off, and so we're past that now. That was about 50 minutes ago. All hell broke loose.
And now it's all nice and quiet, and everybody's back.
No. There's still a few enthusiasts out there fighting the freezing temperatures. To keep everybody awake,
and but eventually everybody will go back in and crank out the aquavit or what have you, and and have a nice nap till tomorrow morning.
They'll probably just go to bed.
Swedes.
Yeah, then the Viking days are gone. They party, but once they get to be about 25 or 30, even that taper.
Bring me my drinking horn. Now I'm going to get a good one on tonight.
Hey, that's what you can call this site, the drinking horn.
Ooh, we just had one, Scott. Beautiful. The drinking horn. Maybe we could, you know what, we could do a once-a-week show devoted to fine libations.
Yeah, well, you don't want to get me started on creative ideas, or I'll just flood your email box with this.
Well, I'm still getting through the last one, and you got a lot of good ideas there. I love the idea of a round table and this sort of collective idea having gathering kind of thing, and just, you know, working through and finding. Well, I tell you what would be one of the handiest things. And I don't want to step on Guy's toes or anything, but the same thing would apply to him because, both he and I, you know, on the archives at White Rose, you know, it just shows the date and nothing about content. And that idea that you had where we would put together a gang of volunteers who would, send a synopsis just for attaching to the date so people could know what was said, what was done that day. That's a wonderful idea.
Don't you hear that, folks? We're scheming.
Brainstorming with one brain in Sweden and not much of one in West Virginia.
Yeah. That kind of comment. Did you hear a guy's interview with, what's his name, Muhammad Ali from Palestine in the Gaza Strip?
Yes, I did. And I was fit to be tied.
And I so love the way Guy was—he was fighting to keep his composure. And that's what you got to love about Guy. He has such a heart.
He does, and that's why I say he's my favorite guy on the horn, because he does
think. Unintended.
Oh yeah! Oh no! No! But delightfully apropos. But beyond the pun, yeah, he's my favorite guy on the horn. Because he tries to maintain that Midwestern rectitude, and every now and then you can just see the sort of shingles flying off the roof, and you know, oh, guy's gonna lose this battle. And that's what I felt like listening to that interview. Because
yeah, well that so enraged me that I got jumped on my computer and sent letters off to all my Congress critters and. He really inspired me to write on that one.
Well, and theoretically, that's what this medium should do. But there's, I suppose, no guarantee. But you know, when we can get people to move, this is an activist audience, Scott. And when we can tap into that activism, and you know what you were talking about, expanding the reach, and involving more people in the dialogue about what it means to be activist, then we can. Then we can start shaking things up a little bit. And you know, Go ahead. No, please.
I want to start a thread on the thread section of the website. I hardly ever get over there, and it's kind of dumb of me. But that'd be a good place maybe to have kind of a round table of ideas to start a thread.
That would be a good idea, and everybody listening, what Scott's describing is the message board at headonradionetwork.com, and you know we urge people to you know make it their own, because it's not there for the egos of the hosts or anything. It's to prompt a dialogue when the dialogue's not going on air. So that'd be a great use of it.
Yeah, because it's hard to get people fall into the same time and space. Chat room works pretty well during the show, but everybody's usually in too high of spirits for some sort of serious conversation.
Well, between that and the food porn, you know, what do you want people to do? So.
Oh, food porn. I ought to start getting into my Scandinavian food porn.
Oh, I'd love it if you did.
You ever heard of surströmming?
No, but I want to.
Oh, you're like this. You take herring. Okay, and this goes way back in the days, way up there in the top of the Baltic, where it's not quite salty enough for sea critters, but herring is one of those that can kind of go both ways. It can live in the ocean, it can live in the...
Yeah, what's the word for that? Brackish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And way back when, they didn't always have enough salt to pickle
the herring, and they didn't always have enough vinegar and everything. You know, times could be kind of
tough up there, yeah, sure.
So they fermented the herring.
Is this like lutefisk?
Oh, this is worse.
Worse? There's worse than lutefisk?
This is so much worse than lutefisk. This is, and I keep seeing on the chat site, they're using the Norwegian spelling again.
Heathens.
Fermented herring, literally, if a bacteria goes on there, it breaks it up, it begins to rot it, but the toxins from the bacteria aren't deadly. But they do prevent it from going even worse. So then it starts to swell. You can see, you get these cans, and they have this in, you have to do this in August, because it starts to be warm enough you can open the cans outdoors, because you can't open them indoors. The smell is about a skunk. At close range.
Wow.
And this is, these cans, you buy them, and the tops and the bottoms are bulging out. It's extra hard soldering to keep those cans intact. And it is truly the most vile thing I think you can have in the Western world. And there may be some things in jungles that are comparable to this.
All of a sudden, I'm imagining a plate of that stuff with a side dish of that delicacy, that Mexican delicacy of the fungally infested corn, and maybe what else is extra nasty?
That's pretty nasty. We can take away from that. But I tell you, there is an ulterior motive behind preserving the food this way, because
keeps people from asking for seconds.
Right now, it's this bad and this nasty, there's only one thing you can do, and that is open the schnapps bottle to try to dull your senses.
Well, so darn right.
That, I think, is the ultimate point, at least in modern times, when it isn't just a matter of the sheer survival.
See, I'd have to be into the schnapps bottle before that stuff got open.
Deep into the schnapps bottle.
Yeah, I don't know what I dare you to drink this is in Swedish. or I dare you to eat this, you know, properly slurred.
Well, everybody has to try it in Sweden. I mean,
the downside to socialism.
Well, there's got to be some. We gave up the battle axes, okay, and the plundering and the pillaging, but they still have to have some sort of a manliness, you know, womanness sort of macho or machismo. For giving the dip into the wrong language. So that's it.
Wow. And, well, you know, we may have to maybe come this time next year or something. May have to, actually, it'd be in the spring, but you'd have to figure out some way to keep them frozen or fresh or something. You need some ramps to go with that herring.
Ramps.
Are you too Ohio for ramps, Scott?
Well, you're talking about Ohio with an O or Ohio with an A, because it's like you go north of I-70 or south of I-70. It's the northern versus the southern accent.
Well, I just, you know, I wondered, you know, because there's that string of mountains right across the river from, like, Wheeling and Parkersburg and so forth. But that's probably not Appalachian.
The Hills.
Yeah. Here in Appalachia, come spring, we and it's the first green thing that pokes its head through the ground. And therefore it's cherished as a tonic, and you know whatever is, and it's an acquired taste. But a ramp, the word derives from the old English or perhaps old Welsh, ramsech, which means garlic.
Okay.
But a ramp, it's a broadleaf little thing, and it pokes its little head up through the ground, and you dig them, and it looks like a broadleafed green onion. And I don't know it's the vegetative equivalent of strontium 90.
It's even skunk cabbage.
No. It's a distant kin to leeks and garlic and onions. But it is the most profound stuff you have ever gotten around. There was a wonderful old man who for years published a paper here in the hills called the West Virginia Hillbilly. And it went literally all over the world. And one year, just to give his readers a treat, he dumped a little test tube vial full of ramp juice. Not distilled, not concentrated, just ramp juice into the entire vat of his printer's ink. And the United States Postal Service informed him personally that if he ever did that again, they would it's not like what happened during the First World War where, you know, the socialist papers got. No, they said they would revoke his mailing privileges if he ever did that again, because one newspaper was enough to foul an entire truckload of mail. If you can imagine. So I don't know, you know, a little bit of sautéed ramps next to that pickled herring.
Yeah, it's a good thing that you don't have a large Swedish audience right now, because many of them would be just salivating, thinking that they'd have this as a side dish for their soup. But I mean,
well, yeah, I can imagine.
Those two sound like they belong together.
And we get real militant and weepy about our ramps here too. Come spring, every volunteer fire department, every Masonic lodge, every ladies auxiliary, every political organization in a political year has a ramp dinner.
You know what, Bob? I just thought of something. Have Appalachians ever wondered why they're a little bit ostracized down here in the hills and nobody even wants them out of there?
Don't try telling us. But, yeah.
I think you've just been, in the last couple of minutes, been on the answer.
Ramps.
It's the ramp.
Yeah, ramps. Yeah, absolutely. But oh,
that's
daggum,
it.
But daggum, they're good. You know,
it's so enticing sounding.
Well, I was trying to do something different, because what you usually do is you chop a few up in an iron skillet of fried potatoes, or you chop some into some brown beans. Well, I decided to get all culinary one year. And I made it. I took a creamy leek soup recipe and made it out of ramps instead, with the same amount of ramps that were called for in leeks.
Did you have to put it on the stove, or did it kind of like cook itself right there in the pot?
It just about cooked itself in the pot, and you could smell my kitchen from the mouth of the road, which is a quarter mile away.
Is this where the Rebel Yell got started?
No, but I did a couple of shots while I was doing that, and that may account for it, too.
Woo!
Yeah. So, you know, man, we got a meal here. They grow in a cool, kind of dark, dank climate in the earliest part of the year. I don't know. Maybe we could get them to grow in Sweden. We could probably change the culture, Scott.
I'm pretty satisfied with the culture as it is. It has some benefits that I'd really hate to see jeopardized by a little carelessness from a little extracurricular biological activity.
Yeah, a little ramp goes a long way. I personally think Don Blankenship hates ramps, and that's why he's blowing up all our mountains. And apparently he hates ginseng. And morel mushrooms, they come along about turkey season in May. And, oh, those are yummy. You just got to soak them for a while to get all the little itchy bits.
We actually had morels up there in northern Ohio.
Yeah, well, and around here they're Molly Moochers.
What are they called?
Yeah, Molly Moochers. And, you got to soak them for a little bit to get the creepy little spiders out of the little crenellations in the caps and stuff. And, oh, they're yummy. So, but you know, you blow up a mountain, you lose the morels, the ginseng, the ramps, the slippery elm bark, the deer, the turkeys, the little things that creep and crawl.
So, your doctor, does he allow you to eat fish?
Yes. Encourages me to.
Really?
Yes.
Little strummies?
Not so much. I don't know.
If I sent you a can of the fermented herring...
You know what? Because my hero is Tony Bourdain, I would be honor bound to open them and to
outdoors.
Eat them.
Outdoors. You have to open them outdoors.
Outdoors, yes.
And have a microphone going on and tape recorded the experience?
You know, we might do it live on air, Scott.
Okay.
And I've got a 30-foot mic cable and I can sort of walk it around and out the studio door, and we could have Agnes standing there, and Ferg and Margie and Doodle, and we could have a chorus of "Oh Jesus" when it was open.
Or Spaghetti Monster or whatever.
I don't know. We might need to work on our Swedish for "Oh Dear God." Yeah.
Okay, but I'll have to send you the authentic recipe too. There's actually a preferred way of making it.
Do you have to make it outside too?
You don't want to open them indoors. It lingers in any like fabric material and
thank God Saddam Hussein didn't have this stuff. We would have nuked him.
Do you have a small, what do they call them? They call them almond potatoes here. They're small red potatoes, kind of the size and shape of a swollen thumb.
the fingerlings?
Well, they're the potatoes.
Yeah, that sounds like a fingerling.
Skin.
I think you can get those over at one of the better grocery stores, not my local.
Okay, yeah. That's part of the recipe. Okay.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. You said recipe, and I thought you meant, for how to make this stuff from the beginning.
You got to go to the machine and catch yourself.
First steal a herring,
No, it's you can work from the can. Believe me, that's the pure drama of opening the can is well worth it. Okay.
Well, wonderful. I tell you what, you probably need to get to bed, and I look forward to hearing from you, and I will haunt the mailbox.
Well, when it arrives, you'll know.
Okay. the postal service will probably.
Well, luckily, it is in a can, so that'll do it.
But okay, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun, Scott. I always love hearing from you.
And I want to say hello to everybody out there in the Horn. I never get a chance to say hello to them because I always listen on the podcast. And even though they all sound like they should be some sort of a buddy, it never hurts me. But I like them all. You got some real good folks out there, and I just love listening to the program.
And it's so much fun to hear from you. And I love that. I'm so simple. I'm still just stunned and amazed that I can get a phone call from Sweden. I know. I'm being dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century, but yeah.
I once called my grandmother. She was born in the 1800s, and she's from Brownstown, Texas. Well, Brownsville, way down there. And I once called her up on the phone, and I couldn't even speak to her. She just spent the whole time, "You're calling from Sweden? Europe?" And she just couldn't get over it. And it was just too much for her mind.
Well, this couldn't happen on terrestrial radio, but by God, it can happen here. Scott, thank you so very much, and a very happy New Year to you. And don't tell them about the ramps.
No, that'll just have to be Appalachia's second secret.
Well, Denmark and Danish and Norwegian TV have been over to. Have been down in the Coal River Valley and everything, looking at the mountaintop removals and stuff. If Swedish TV ever makes it over here and happens to be in the spring, we'll load them up with ramps for the trip home.
Oh, you do that.
Yeah, because they will freeze, and you can keep them until New Year's, and then once that happens with the herring, all bets are off.
Well, herring is August.
Okay. Well, they'll definitely keep till August in the freezer.
Well, there you go.
All right, Scott, take care, and a happy new year to you.
Good night, Thor. Hello.
Good night. Calling from Sweden, our good friend Scott. I hear from him email-wise and share his emails with you on a regular basis. Wonderful guy. Transplanted Ohioan. But sounds pretty doggone happy in the socialist paradise. I don't want anybody to, march in front of my studio or anything, but I think I'd like to have me some of that socialism. Call me crazy, but, just saying. Let's see. Bedtime for Bonzo is who Scott is in the chat room. So that's who you just heard from. We'll keep things rolling along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
There's Preston. Yeah, what's up?
Hello. Just enjoying these fascinating discussions you're having. Was that a fish that Scott was talking about?
Yeah, it's a fermented herring that apparently has a darn near toxic half-life.
And he said something about the bacteria doing something?
Yeah, the bacteria is what brings on the fermentation, but it's not dangerous to human consumption. I guess the same way that bacteria make the holes in Swiss cheese or the little blue veins in Roquefort and Bleu cheese.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
But, you know, whenever you run across one of those, I don't know if you're like me, Preston, whenever you run across one of those foods, the first thing that comes to my mind is, who ate that first? Who said, hey, Ma, don't eat that? No, it's pretty good.
Well, I know some of the indigenous people, they'd kind of observe animals at times, too, and see how they responded to it. There's a saying, I think, a Navajo saying, or a Cherokee, something like, if a rabbit nibbles it, we can smoke it. So.
I love the attitude. Yeah, they're not talking about eating. They're talking about smoking it.
Yeah.
If the rabbit looks happy, we will be, too.
You also mentioned other foods that utilize bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the corn, that kind of rotting corn.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's a word for it.
It's corn smut.
Smut. Imagine me forgetting the word smut.
Actually, I was just reading about it on Wikipedia. They have an interesting write-up on it. And it, one section says, considered a pest in most of the United States, smut feeds off the corn plant and decreases the yield. However, in Mexico, corn smut is called huitlacoche, which is a Nahuatl word reportedly meaning raven's excrement, and it's considered a delicacy.
Yes.
And it's being preserved and sold for a higher price than corn. So there's a market for it, you know?
Oh, gosh, yes.
And the ancient tradition for it as well. And, you know, it's interesting how we can define something like that as the enemy and seek to destroy what we consider a blight. So they utilize all these antifungals, fungicides, to destroy what could be a useful thing. It's like with pests. You know, we define them as pests. And we bring out the pesticides and kill the pests. And other people in other countries see it and say, no, this is an important food source.
Yeah, that looks like that doesn't look like a pest. That looks like dinner.
Yep.
But bear in mind, Preston, that if Monsanto ever figures out a way to get a patent on huitlacoche, they will advertise it and tell us that we're all a bunch of barbarian heathens if we don't eat it.
True. True. Yep.
Yeah, I just went to the same page that you went to, and I'm looking at huitlacoche now. And of course, I love the Nahuatl language. I think there's something incredibly beautiful about it because I think in the writing of the Spaniards when they arrived in Mexico, the kindest thing they could say was that it was a horrible. They called it the horrible, unlovely language because they couldn't wrap their Spanish tongues around those indigenous North American words.
Mm. Interesting. I heard there's one language, I forget what it is, but it utilizes singing and whistling. I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, I heard some thing on NPR one time about the fact that native speakers of Asian languages, the idea of that there's pitch as well as pronunciation and force, engenders that changes the way one absorbs concepts like music.
Yeah,
because the pitch, I know we've got listeners in mainland China. The pitch of a word in Mandarin or one of the other tongues can change the meaning from from mother to bilge water. Just based not on spelling or not on written representation or anything like that, but just the mere up or downward pitch of the voice as the word is spoken.
Right, tonal language. Yeah, very interesting.
So you're a couple of hours behind us, Preston. I'm assuming Denver's all set for the you know, we call a buddy of mine turned me onto this. Calls New Year's Eve amateur night. But I assume. Denver's hopping tonight.
Oh, I would imagine. I actually live next door to a bar. And it's interesting. It was a really quiet little hole in the wall when I moved here, but it got kind of became more of a sports bar. And
so many did.
Yeah. And it's really popular, and they get packed a lot. And, yeah, that place is often hopping. Mostly it's people having a good time, and it's kind of enjoyable. And I'm over there myself every now and again. They have a nice patio. It's a shame to see how many people smoke. I mean, it's like sometimes like 70% of the people on the patio smoke cigarettes. And, again, not totally a bad thing to smoke, but I don't know. It's a little.
It's tough to be in if you don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be the first to admit that.
Yeah. And sometimes people are fighting, you know. I mean, alcohol brings out a lot of aggression. People squeal in their tires at times and stuff like that. But, yeah, but I'm sure it'll be hopping tonight. And actually, I wanted to get back to that pest thing. And
sure, absolutely, pests, absolutely.
Things to be exterminated and fungicides and all that stuff. You know, it's sad how that kind of pattern of thought can even extend into human interactions and the Palestinians being defined as the current pests to be destroyed. And it's been really discouraging to hear, you know, Obama's line about, well, if people are sending Qassam rockets to my country, I'd do everything to protect my daughters, and Israel should do that too.
But doesn't that apply to the Palestinians too, Preston?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, if you're sending American-made helicopter gunships to rocket your children, don't you do what you can to resist?
Right. It's so obvious, you know, and it's such manipulation to just leave the argument like that and not point out the obvious, the missiles that we're making, that we're sending there. I mean, simply a rhetorical ploy, and it's really disappointing to hear him using it and hear so many other liberal progressive people using similar arguments. And but what's been encouraging is how listeners have responded. And I heard this lady call in, Tabitha, in Buffalo, and she was brilliant. And people citing Rachel Corrie when they call in and citing UN resolutions, people aren't buying it. And I don't know, I think there's something very hopeful in that. Have you seen this at all? I don't know if...
Well, I mean, I'm familiar with Rachel Corrie, and, but what you're referring to, not specifically, no. But, you know, before I started my program here, I ran a rerun of Mark Levine does a show on WPFW in Washington, D.C., which is a Pacifica station.
Yep.
And
I caught that rerun.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, on this end, it was mighty tough to listen to, because I get the notion, and I feel a little weird about talking about somebody who's not here to defend himself. And
right.
Lord knows Mark has any opportunity he may possibly want, but I have never once heard him say Israel is wrong, not once.
Right, and likewise, I have a lot of respect for Mark. I've called him a couple times and really enjoy our exchanges, and we disagree on a fair amount of stuff, but again, there again, I thought the callers were brilliant.
Oh, the woman who wouldn't let him get away with calling them missiles?
That, I mean, is one right after the other. I saw the same thing on Richard Green's show, Clout. Ed Schultz, I think, was good. I think he was trying to stay as neutral as he could, and again, there, his callers were great. And not even saying that people talking about Israel are wrong per se. It's just, here's some other truths. You know them yourselves. You're just not speaking them. Here they are.
I wasn't kidding last night, Preston, when I said, I hope somebody has already sent the letter off, to Norway to, nominate, in all sincerity, nominate Cynthia McKinney for the Nobel Peace Prize.
That would be great. If not that, at least the Right Livelihood Award, which is kind of an alternative Nobel.
Oh, wow.
They usually award three people a year in different fields, and they focus on people who are doing things to address problems, to provide solutions. And one of the winners this past year was Amy Goodman. another thing that's happening. People are really being informed by shows like Democracy Now.
She's doing a tremendous job, especially, I mean, she does a great job 365 days a year.
Yep.
But she's doing a brilliant job with regard to this particular story.
Yep, yep.
And I'm just, see, I don't have the brains for this issue, Preston, because I get all caveman. And the thing that comes into my head is, let's find the guys on both sides, from the top of the command chain to the bottom of the command chain.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find the Israelis and let's find the Palestinians who are doing this.
Yep.
And give them all ball bats, and say, you know, you rotten bastards, if you want to kill. Kill each other, and then maybe the rest of the people can live.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I recognize that's a very, very, I even hate to say caveman, because it turns out they were probably more civilized than we are. It's a very visceral reaction on my part, and I can't get the image of that father carrying his dead son out of my head. It won't go away when I close my eyes, and with my eyes wide open, it doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there is an American alive who has the first concept. You know, maybe some of the people in the lower Ninth Ward have a concept of what life in Gaza is like.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, the depth of the poverty, the profundity of the despair. And what in heaven's name, and this is, you know, this is stuff of Israel's creation. They ran the blockades. They have kept, you know, a siege is an act of war.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's no getting around that. And to deprive civilians of drinking water, electricity, transportation, employment,
medical
care and supplies. They're turning people away from hospitals in Gaza. They're doing surgery. What they can do, surgeons are doing surgery without anesthetics, Preston. And I'm supposed to feel like Israel is the aggrieved party in this?
Yep.
And, I hate to pick sides. And I really do. I call damnation down on everybody who is doing this. But there are elements of both societies that do not want peace, and they're not the ones who are getting hurt. And you know, the Israelis showed to us that even their own society won't tolerate men of peace. You know, look what happened a few years ago. A man who was legitimately working toward peace, bang, dead.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And just as it was with Gandhi, it was one of his own who did him in.
Yep.
And if I've often said that it would be great if some equivalent to Gandhi could arise among the Palestinian people, but I said in the chat room a little bit ago that I have a sneaking suspicion that both sides would be in a race to see who could kill him first.
Right.
The Palestinian leadership itself, or maybe the Mossad.
Yeah,
because there is big business and big money in the slaughter of innocents.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't mean to get so worked up.
I understand. You know, for some great, you know, further context for this, I'd highly recommend the movie at occupation101.com.
I'm familiar with it.
I thought they did a great job with that. There's actually a segment where they play this old clip of Rachel Corrie when she was in elementary school, and she's giving a little speech at the talent show about what she wants to be when she grows up and how she wants to work for peace, and it's just beautiful. And
I've had occasion to hear from some local medical people who live near me, who leave West Virginia periodically and go, when they were allowed to, go and work in the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm. that reminds me, one of the people who called in, I think, to Mark's show has been to the occupied territories. And he was like, you know, another constant manipulation is that, well, Hamas, they target children, kids, and innocent people. Israel doesn't do that. Well, this guy called in and said, I was in the West Bank. I was in Gaza. They most certainly do target civilians. They shoot at children. At the most, you'll see stones being thrown by these kids at tanks. This is right out of the Bible. You know, Eckhart Tolle keeps telling us, you know, forget about the past. In some ways, the past did not go anywhere. And I'm on the side of David. I'll pick sides there. I'm on the side of David versus Goliath.
Isn't it funny how that allegory has been turned around?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, in the court of world opinion, Israel continues to try to paint itself as the David.
Yep, totally. They'll constantly say, "Oh, it's so small. It's so small." They leave out the part about having the fifth largest military in the world. And Gaza's kind of small too, by the way, if you haven't noticed.
There's no there.
Yep.
But, you know, there's Yitzhak Rabin, again, murdered by his own people for daring to suggest peace. And one of the things that he said that has always stuck with me is, what was it? Human history is writ in blood, and it's time we found a new kind of ink.
Definitely. Definitely. wanted to mention something also. Kate was thinking about a different kind of word. It's not quite global warming. It's something else.
Oh, Juanita, yeah.
Hey, Juanita, yes, that's right. And actually, there's a group here, the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is an internationally renowned sustainable design place, engineering. They suggested the term global weirding. It'll be hot places. It'll be super cold other places. It'll be crazy winds, incredible rainfalls, incredible droughts, going in a lot of different directions. So global weirding, they suggest.
Global weirding. Oh, wow. Yeah, because climates in any given place, because of what happens globally, climates don't make sense anymore. The seasons don't make sense anymore. That's a great turn of phrase.
I saw a statistic, I forget where, maybe Ode magazine or something like that, but it asked, do you believe in climate change and do you think it's man-made kind of thing? And among Republicans, the percentage who did believe in that was around 30%. And with Democrats, it was like 60%. And among the world scientists, it was 80%. So, and certainly I hold the possibility that the scientists, the majority there, maybe they're wrong. In fact, hopefully they are wrong.
It would be nice if they are.
Yeah.
But even if they are, continuing to pump toxic pollutants into the planet, onto the planet, is not... You know, the status quo ante is not acceptable.
Yep, and we can completely put aside global warming or global weirding considerations. There's a mountain of problems with that, ignoring those problems, you know. Or there was a mountain, you know, before we blew it apart, and the pollution and the... You've been doing great work on the Tennessee spill, by the way.
Thank you. Just because I haven't really brought it up this evening doesn't mean that there's nothing more coming out. There's stunning data being released, and the people down there are getting rather angry because of the lies that they were told for a solid week before the truth started coming out. And it's the New York Times did a good piece yesterday. And just, you know, laid out what's in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
And for TVA to blithely say they'll have it cleaned up in 4 to 6 weeks, what they're talking about is, cosmetically acceptable. But the fact of the matter is, all this stuff is being taken back to the Kingston Fossil Plant, the same place it came from. When TVA released water samples saying that the water was safe to drink, they had tested water upstream from the spill. Upstream, Preston. You know, that's not a mistake. That is a deliberate attempt to mislead the public about a poisoning hazard.
Yeah.
Get these statistics. As far as the Tennessee Valley Authority is concerned, the fossil plant poisons in 1 year, just 1 year, Preston, included 45,000 pounds of arsenic, 49,000 pounds of lead, 1.4 million pounds of barium, 91,000 pounds of chromium, and 140,000 pounds of manganese in 1 year. Now, how many years have they been piling that ash there?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even have to be the pit that the dam was holding back was not even required by law to have any sort of liner. So it's been sitting there for decades, leaching into the groundwater, leaching into the river, even before the dam broke.
Another dirty bomb, not brought to you by Al-Qaeda, but by your friends in the...
Your friends in the deregulated power industry.
The industrial aristocracy. Or what FDR called them, the princes of...
Princes of industry? Yeah. Wasn't that it?
Yeah, I think so. If people can't get motivated on protecting the health of their children, and, you know, I don't know. Hopefully they'll...
You know, Preston, in many ways, I don't think it's a motivation issue. I think it's more of a despair issue.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's huge. I mean, we talk a lot about how the right wing is controlled through fear. I think oftentimes we've been controlled through despair.
It's too big. I can't do it. I'm just me.
There's a natural despair that I think is understandable. And then there's a cultivating of it to neutralize us. You know, again, it's...
Absolutely. But, you know, I think about that scene in Aaron Brockovich.
Yeah.
Where when they say the water is safe to drink, she offers a glass to one of the executives. And, you know, frankly, I'm not trying to be a heathen, but it wouldn't break my heart one bit for somebody to stand up with a glass of well water and offer it to TVA administrator Tom Kilgore. Because, you know, at $2.4 million a year, he doesn't have to worry about his water. He's got the money to have it flown in from a melting iceberg in Greenland.
Right.
But, you know, if he won't drink it, neither should you.
Right.
And neither should we. But this is stuff that is, if you heard John Wathen, the ash plume is definitely into the Tennessee River. And there are no end of public drinking supplies that are fed by the Tennessee River. And our first conversation, he said, I don't want to stir up a hysteria. But I don't think that telling the truth is stoking hysteria. This stuff is going downstream.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the animals and the fish... You know, and cycling it all through them, and then people eating the fish, and God, terrible. But, you know, speaking of people getting motivated and the potential to make things a little better, I read an article yesterday about how Mexico City has cleaned their air. Not entirely. There's ozone issues that remain, but in the past, kids used to use brown crayons to draw the sky, and you know, birds were actually falling dead out of the sky, and a lot of people were in surgical masks. But they closed down a power plant. They brought in unleaded gas, catalytic converters. And between now and 2012, they're going to spend $3 billion on mass transit.
So, and they'll have a chance. And when I think about the historical, what that place was in, what was it, 1518?
Mm-hmm.
If you can look at a photograph of Mexico City, which is now, is it the largest city on the planet?
It's up there.
The Valley of Mexico was a beautiful, temperate, I don't even think it would qualify as semi-tropical, but a temperate zone, a basin between two mountain ranges. And what we have by way of remembering it were the remarks of the people who were destined to destroy it. And that is, you know, those are the remarks of the Cortez people. And when they crossed the ridge and looked down into the Valley of Mexico and saw this beautiful lake and a city and cities ringing the lake and a city on an island in the middle of the lake that they said put Venice to shame.
Mm-hmm.
In a generation, there was not a tree on the slopes of that valley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yep.
You know, I don't know how you reclaim that, but it's a part of a heritage.
Yeah. Well, one idea is, have you ever seen the cartoon, or cartoon's not the right word, animated film called The Man Who Planted Trees?
No.
It's been called one of the top 50 animated films of all time. It was made in, I think, around mid-80s, maybe. I think it's French. Beautiful story, incredible allegory to political work as well. But anyway, more recently, there's a woman who's planting trees. You know, Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Peace Prize and the Right Livelihood Award for her work in Kenya, replanting trees and orchards, fruit trees, shade trees. So maybe it can be reclaimed in Mexico. I don't know. Maybe it can be reclaimed in the hills where you're at. I don't know. Some version of it, maybe some new manifestation. I don't know. I think it can be. I don't know. I think.
But the key in both instances, Preston, is to stop its demolition.
Yes.
We can't try to reclaim anything. We can't try to restore anything until they stop, because they destroy it far too fast for us to be able to do anything with it.
Stop the destruction, and also don't let others define what remediation will be. You know, don't let them plant grasses that are completely inappropriate.
Non-native, yeah, and very, very much, it's not the right word, malicious grasses.
Invasive.
Invasive, there we go.
You know, I actually want to hear your other callers, but before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, I'm making a little list on Amazon, and I'm going to title it Progressive West Virginia. And I'm trying to find things about West Virginia, like authors or figures who are like, you know, have a legacy of progressive work that we should know about. And, you know, people like filmmakers, a filmmaker from West Virginia, I'm going to include him on the list. You know, Super Size Me, that guy.
Oh, yeah. And don't forget, of course, our dear friend down in Greenbrier County, who has been B.J. Goodmanson, Rise Up West Virginia and Mountain Morning. She's an extraordinary human being. From a literature standpoint, he has been gone a long, long time. But we had an individual, and I would recommend this man's work to anybody who loves good writing. A guy named Brees D.J. Pancake. He only wrote short stories, if I understand correctly, and he died in an accidental death or a suicide far too early in his life. But to read a short story of his like Trilobites is to be absolutely blown away with just a quantum of writing talent that can't be comprehended.
Wow.
The guy who wrote
who Who were the labor people? I think there's someone born in West Virginia, a Detroit labor person.
Oh, gosh, yeah, the Reuthers.
That's it.
Walter Reuther.
That's it.
And, you know, there's a whole chapter on all of this in Jeff Bigger's The United States of Appalachia. And it's a great roadmap for just understanding the tremendous contributions that this state and this region have given to the country. And I continue to encourage anyone who wants to know about this region to use that as their starting place. Because it's you come away from it just, wow. And you're hard-pressed to say that the country, that any other region of the country has contributed more. And frankly, received less.
Yeah.
But there are great filmmakers here. There are wonderful musicians here. Authors of profound note. You know, I find it interesting that we refer to Pearl Buck, whose work was just magnificent. But we refer to her as a West Virginia author when, in fact, she was born here and spent a couple of years here and then spent the rest of her life in China growing up because her parents were missionaries. But it's hard to read something like The Good Earth and not feel like something about Appalachian existence informs the way that that's described. You ever read that?
The Good Earth. I just noted it, and I've heard of it. I haven't read it. I should...
I'm pretty sure it won the Pulitzer Prize, maybe even the Nobel. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it's a magnificent story of a peasant family in transitioning China, and you can't come away with it without just feeling like you've been through a transformative experience.
Great. I'll definitely be checking that out.
And of course the beautiful mind guy, can't remember his name right now, West Virginian. Any list would be incomplete without Homer Hickam. You know, the Rocket Boys.
Matewan. Isn't that West Virginia based?
Well, it is Matewan,
I mean,
West Virginia.
Not a progressive story. I mean, it's oppressed labor, but you know the struggle.
But the oppression of labor and the rise of working people happened here.
Yeah.
You know, if you study up, you'll find that Walter Reuther and what he did with the UAW in Detroit was informed by the life he led here. The film by John Sayles is brilliant. And it's just called Matewan. And I watch that every 3 or 4 months. Just need a refresher because it was just such brilliant filmmaking. And it's like we were talking on one of our last conversations. I've got this. I've just got to get this question answered about war is a racket name.
Smedley Butler.
Smedley Butler. I've just got to find out what he was doing in West Virginia.
You know, I looked at that book, The Maverick Marine. I checked out the index to see if there was something on West Virginia in that, and I didn't see anything. So that would be great if you find something.
And it may just be apocryphal, but it's there. I think in the Wikipedia bio, and Lord knows it wouldn't be the first time that something's been off there. But that's a seed of something happening in my brain that. Oh, it could be a screenplay, screen treatment. It could be a novel. It could be a play, because it's the possibilities of him running across Mother Jones and having his worldview later shaken by that. That's Road to Damascus stuff. You know what I mean?
Definitely. You know, speaking of Bible stories, I've been watching this video from PBS on Peter and Paul.
Yes.
They do. PBS does such great work. They did this series on mysteries of the Bible and, you know, how they framed it and the narratives they provided were very, it was helpful, instructive in some ways and radical, actually, in many ways. And there was a section where they're talking about Luke and he made this comment about people selling their things and sharing their wealth, and to each according to their need. And
yes.
I looked that up further, you know, and of course we condemn Karl Marx for saying that.
But he pulled it out of the Bible.
Right, right.
Marxists.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
We held, in the King James Version, it's something like, and we held all things in common.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, communism, we just kind of have accepted that, you know, we should have a war on communism and bomb the hell out of them wherever they may be. Now it's terrorism. You know, what is communism exactly? And I was glad you talked about socialism. Chris Hedges recently, he had an article called Why I Am a Socialist or something like that. I mean, the way the right wing, I mean, they did a number on the word liberal, but what they did with socialist is even worse. And
well, that's why I made that reference in talking with Scott about what the United States government did during the First World War. A lot of the free speech cases were brought as a function of the revocation of mailing privileges by the Postmaster General. You know, you and I think about the post office, and it seems like this innocuous, you know, this innocuous thing that puts junk mail in our box every day.
Mm-hmm.
But it was used as an iron-fisted tool, an absolute cudgel in the second decade of the 20th century to stifle dissent, because there was a burgeoning socialist movement
mm-hmm.
in this country prior to the Second World War, and it scared the living bejabbers out of industrial America, out of, you know, the Andrew Carnegies and the Mellons and the Rockefellers.
The elite.
Yep.
Didn't like it.
The story of the Molly Maguires and how that was handled, and the frame job that was done there prior to the execution of the man whose name I can't remember right now, is you know, just another horror labor story. And that guy, the guy who set those who set up the Molly Maguires, he came to West Virginia too and started doing his dirty stuff all over again here.
Wow. You know, I noticed there's a movie, I think, the Molly Maguires.
Yes, Sean Connery, I believe.
Okay. Does that do the story justice? Or
it's a darn compelling film to watch. It can't, of course, encapsulate everything, but it's very, very good.
Worth checking out.
It's worth checking out. I don't think it's been so long since I've seen it. I don't think you'll be entirely pleased by the perspective, but there's enough of the facts there to sort of make your blood boil.
Okay.
And you know, again, this is all stuff that we don't teach. This is stuff that you know, that I teach my children, because I know darn good and well that throughout their public education, they won't get it in this county, and if they go to university, virtually anywhere, they're going to have to go deeply into the esoteric area ends of the history department before they ever even run across a smattering of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell you know, I tell my boy and I tell my girls about Two Gun Sid Hatfield.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I try to mention Ludlow, you know, here in Colorado.
Yes.
And, you know, thankfully, people like Howard Zinn have done a lot of work to, you know, help us remember our labor history and the way the Socialist Workers' Party was attacked and, you know, what they succeeded in and how they worked. And, and remember, there are a lot of political battles going on in places like the post office, in places like the public library.
Yes.
And we need to try to keep abreast of that stuff, because now...
Well, when the Bush administration wanted to crack down, where was the first place they went, Preston? They went to the library.
Yeah. And sometimes that has a chilling effect on people. I've had people tell me that they don't check books out of the library anymore because they don't want to get on some list. And I'm like, I understand your concern, but...
Well, I do that in the commercial realm. Because anymore, and I didn't learn that from the Bush administration. I learned that in the rabid hunting of Bill Clinton. You know, because when that nasty little beady-eyed, bespectacled pornographer Ken Starr went after him, the first thing he did is he started looking through Monica Lewinsky's purchase records at a bookstore.
Oh, jeez.
And that's how they found out that he gave her, or she gave him, or something, a copy of The Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman.
And
good choice, I must say.
Absolutely. But by the same token, nobody's gone further or done more to try to turn the leaves of grass into something dirty than Kenneth Starr, who, by the way, has joined the Prop 8 campaign in California. I don't know if you were aware of that or not, but, yeah, he's on board as counsel to argue the Prop 8 case before the Supreme Court of the state of California. But anyway, so what happens is they'll database you when you go to buy a book. You know, you'll get that Borders Rewards card or whatever, and I'm not gooning on Borders or Walden Books or B. Dalton or any of these people. But they've got this rewards card.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You scan the little barcode, and congratulations, your purchase of Spank Me, I've Been Naughty has just gone into a database that can be accessed by the FBI at the push of a button.
Right, right. And
you got to remember those national security letters, no warrant, and the person having it served on them is forbidden by law from telling anyone and has been told that they cannot even appeal it to a court of competent jurisdiction.
Yeah, and again, I do understand those concerns. And then, you know, sometimes there can be job implications, threats of job implications, and, you know, just public humiliation issues. But, I think these are risks, you know, are things we just kind of need to plow through, work with. Because if we stand back because of those fears, that kind of empowers them. I mean, if we're not checking books out of the library, that's, you know how that's kind of dangerous?
It's that enforced despair, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Despair, there's fear. There's certainly fear on the left. There's not knowing how to be an activist, how to organize, what that really means. You know, maybe sometimes we're too narrowly defining it as, you know, big marches of hundreds of thousands of people in the street, and we're saying, oh.
Activism is a cup of coffee on a front porch.
There you go. There you go. Activism is buying books and checking them out, you know, saying we're not going to be intimidated by these lists. We're going to see them as a badge of honor. And I want to say also, I've been looking more at this Eckhart Tolle person. And again, I don't know if you're familiar with him at all, but Oprah Winfrey recommended him. Sean Hannity recommended him.
Yeah, I after we talked about him, I went and read up a little bit, but I haven't read, you know, with any depth.
Okay, and nor have I. I've heard him, though, a few times, and a lot of it I don't like, but I can understand if people get something out of it, and I think that's great, because I think there are elements of it that are useful. I mean, there's like, it's like a hodgepodge of things, and some things that are kind of Buddhist, some things that are kind of, reasonable, perfectly reasonable in a lot of ways.
Well, and from what little I've read of it, it sort of reminds me of something that was referred to in days gone by as theosophy.
Okay.
And that was something that was in vogue in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and eventually morphed into Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
And it takes, you know, a little dash of Buddhism, a little dash of Hinduism, and maybe some Sufi Islam and some Jewish mysticism, and throws it together with a little bit of the risen Christ to leaven something that you can give people and have them say that, you know, if I'm just positive all my days, I'll live a happy life.
Yeah.
And I get that sense from this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there are segments where he talks about not being a victim. And, you know, I'm sorry, but some people have been victimized at times, you know. And
when somebody is laying on the pavement just having been hit by a car, and you walk over to them and tell them that the first thing they have to do is understand that they're not a victim, that's actually, I think that's something approaching sociopathic behavior.
Yeah. And again, it's a similarity with those CIA-funded priests who were working the garbage dumps where people were trying to scrape up enough refuse to survive. They'd send these preachers out there or places where other poor would congregate and give these stories about there'll be pie in the sky when you die.
Thank you, Joe Hill. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And there's something else that I discovered, though, about Tolle's work. I don't know if it was the big seller, The Power of Now, or if it was a more recent one, like New World or something. But in it, he cites, of all things, a book by, and he only cites like 7 books. I mean, that's another thing. He doesn't give credit to so many Buddhist texts and the Tao Te Ching and stuff that he's pulling this stuff from. That does it a lot better, I might add.
Yeah.
But he does cite among these books something by Zbigniew Brzezinski, Grand Failure, The Birth and Death of Communism in the 20th Century. I thought that was an odd thing to throw in there amid this, all this enlightened talk. Of all things, he picks is something, again, I go back to those CIA-funded preachers.
Yeah, I know.
Preaching against communists. They were preaching against organizing, people organizing and engaging this class war that's being waged against them. So just another thing about Tolle that's bugging me. Again, there's other things I think are useful.
Well, see, when I ran across that victim business,
mm-hmm.
And I'm primed for all the little lights and whistles and bells and everything to go off when I see anybody describing a culture or a subset or a section of a culture or individuals as victims in a negative fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm very well of these, they're called CALA, Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse groups. And they are the heart and what they are is they're an astroturf organization. They're not grassroots, but they masquerade as citizens groups that are concerned about the perversion of justice in the country from all the nasty plaintiffs' lawyers suing the poor little innocent corporations.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is one of their chief preaching points.
Yeah.
We've become a nation of victims. When are we going to get up on our 2 feet and haul ourselves up by our bootstraps and realize that sometimes life just ain't fair?
Yep. Right.
But it's always fair for the insurance company.
Exactly. Don't you be a victim, but you're going to hear about how we're victimized all the time.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. You can't be a victim, but the insurance company over here, you're victimizing them by trying to get them to pay up on what they promised to do.
Yeah, Michael Medved, the right-wing talk.
There you go.
Almost every single day, he says, the Michael Medved show, where every day we say we're not victims, and then his whole show will be dedicated by how some interest group he's serving is being victimized.
Yeah, it's a right-wing co-opting. You remember Susan Powder back in the 90s?
Mm.
Short blonde hair, and she said, you know, and her catchphrase was stop the insanity.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And you know, refuse and encouraging women to not allow themselves to be in a victim mindset and all of that. And that's a very, very broad generalization. But what Medved has done, what so many other right-wing talkers have done, Preston, is to co-opt that to their own ends.
Yeah, because it can be a useful sentiment. Again, it's how it's being framed. You know, what's the intention? What's your point? I mean, it's good to be empowered. It's good not to just say, you know, things are being done to me all the time and I have no option to respond.
And a classic example of that is, of the corporate end of that, like what Medved's hustling, is the fact that TVA... the coal industry, actually. The coal industry is on the ropes. I mean, what happened in East Tennessee is a solid left hook to their glass jaw.
Mm-hmm.
Because it brings out in just stark relief the reality of coal. And some coal operators association, FLAC, the mouthpiece, flapper, whatever you want to call him, said, well, we think this is just an isolated event. These things happen. But, of course, the environmentalists will try to use it for their own ends. So thereby creating the frame that anybody who goes down, like United Mountain Defense is doing, Preston, who goes down and tests the water, or just try to exploit an unfortunate incident for their own ends, them tree huggers,
fish lickers. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And so many, it's sad how many hanatized people will repeat those lines.
And bear in mind, we're talking about East Tennessee, so there's a lot of hanatized people there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm alone. I hope I'm not. But in recalling that this is the same region that overwhelmingly voted for Bush the first time, voted for Bush the second time, voted for John McCain and Sarah Palin, and created the culture that gave rise to a man with books by Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly in his home and in his car when he went into a Unitarian Universalist congregation in July of this dying year and shot up people because he didn't like the way they were oriented. And the liberals and the gays are killing America.
Right.
There's a little corner in my mind that says, you know, this is just some irony operating here.
Well, it's good, though, that even in a place like Tennessee, there's a progressive spirit showing itself now and again.
It's all over the place. You go into a town like Nashville, and you got a real chance of running into some genuine liberals.
Yeah. And I think they hold one of the biggest outdoor music festivals each year. I think it's called like Coachella or something like that. They have all.
Well, goodness gracious! There's what's the word? Give me a second. Bonnaroo.
That's it. That's the one I was trying to.
There's Bonnaroo, but then there's the Americana Music Festival in Nashville. And I have a real yen, shall we say, to go down and broadcast live from the Americana Festival, because there's a lot of musicians you think of, and I'm not saying he's there, but you think of somebody like Steve Earle.
Yeah.
Steve Earle does not blush to tell you what he thinks would fix America. And here's a hint. It ain't the free market.
That's right.
And that would be, you know, the 2006 election cycle, there was a brilliant band of musicians out of Nashville who put together a coalition to oppose right-wing politics. I mean, these things can be found all over the place. You know, you listen to John Wathen on this program the last couple of nights. I don't want to speak for John, but I'm guessing I could probably guess his voter registration. And he's in Alabama. Okay. Mm-hmm. There are pockets of activism all over these places that are supposedly bright red, but the job for us is to destroy the artificially created walls of isolation. You know, just as Israel built a wall around the occupied territories, the right wing in this country has tried to build a virtual wall around anybody who is activist oriented in this country who wants to see liberal progressive change come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I was preaching again. My bad.
But here and there, we're finding communities.
And when we find them, if we can throw out a rope, and the other side will pick it up, we'll draw each other together. If you were listening to John the last couple of nights, he has specifically mentioned in the same breath as talking about what the ecological, environmental, social, cultural nightmares that are taking place in Appalachia, in the same breath he has mentioned the people the people in the Four Corners area and Black Mesa, who are fighting the same fight as we are.
Yep.
Against the same depredations. And overtures have been made, and contacts have been made, and we here and they there now understand that we are comrades in this struggle. Ooh, I'm using some bad imagery there, aren't I, Preston? Comrades in this struggle. Tovarich! But we are.
Yes. Yeah, we are. I see they've kind of ridiculized those terms in a way, cliched them. That's another thing they do. You know, sometimes Rush will make some comments, and he'll just say the comment and just laugh in this ridiculing way. And, you know, oftentimes they don't even have arguments, Hannity and these people. They just have attitudes.
Yeah.
They're modeling. And, yeah, we need comedy.
And that's all they need in their media model. Preston, I wish you a very, very happy, happy new year. I'm going to see if there's anybody still on these blinking lights. And I look forward to hearing from you in 2009, my friend.
Yeah, likewise. Look forward to it.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And I tell you what I'm going to do. I don't know who's live or not live. I know all I know is that I'm live right now. And so if you want to light up the phones, let's spend New Year's Eve together. I got nothing against going an extra hour tonight. Do you? If you don't want to light the phones up, I understand. But I'm here one way or the other. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. And so, you know, chime right in if you want to. Hey, welcome to the program.
I have an idea about the coal thing that I think is a really good idea.
Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. Yes.
Yes. But after that, I got to strongly disagree with you on something.
Okay, that's all right.
But I think I make a fair, valid point. I've been thinking about it. I noticed on YouTube, and maybe John can clear this up for me, but there needs to be like a town meeting about a place. You type in Harriman, and the only match you get is some news footage and this one emo kid who's really concerned about the spill from 6 days ago. Now, this is what I'm talking about when it comes to that. I don't know what the people in Tennessee. I don't think there's an excuse about having video cameras and taking footage. You can do audio, but I think there needs to be a place that mocks kind of like the YouTube thing. Like they do, they have like porn sites with the word "you" in them.
So yeah.
If you really want to get to that section of people who are typing for those YouTube links, I'm thinking that someone needs to start a video site called You Cole.
Ooh. Ooh. I'm liking that a lot, David.
And the reason why I say that is no disrespect.
You Cole, You Fossil.
CRMW or anything like that. But the real reality is you're dealing with a branding war. And it's the same kind of branding war that I'm dealing with on my site. We're about to launch a new radio station. In case anyone knows, our other radio station, our whole site got sabotaged and hacked, completely destroyed.
Oh.
But that's the industry, and you have to take it like that. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if someone does that to you, Bob, when you start getting rolling. I mean, and don't be surprised if it's a liberal. I'm just telling you.
Yeah.
You know, that's the world, and you just have to take it in stride. So we're starting a site called Generation Next Radio. That's the name of the network.
Very
Generation
cool.
Next. But yeah, branding is important in this day and age because a lot of people don't pay attention to something. When you type in, no one's going to type in CRMW. They're going to stumble it on by accident, but they are going to find You Cole. So maybe CRMW, if you want to be gangster with it, as I would say it, you could buy the You Cole domain and, have it directly linked to, CRMW.
Yeah. And just have it redirect.
Yeah. There's a lot of things you could do with that, but yeah, there needs to.
We're dialoguing about a lot of this, David, there's a lot of dialoguing about this going on, and the whole movement is taking the idea of imaging and message management, even though I hate that phrase, much more seriously, and I have to give tremendous credit to the people at United Mountain Defense for what they've done. Because they're, you know, they're getting stuff up there. There's video there. There's information there. Go ahead.
I'm just thinking in terms of the videos that I'm seeing. I'm just wondering, is this disaster? Would you say this is so stupid to compare? But this is the world we live in. Would you say this disaster is on scale with Katrina?
Yes.
Okay.
It's 100 times the size of the Exxon Valdez spill.
And it is not
comparable to Katrina in short-term death.
Yeah. See, that's a slight problem because people think you're a lot of people will think it's some kind of exaggeration or people getting hysterical over nothing.
That is the message that the coal people and the fossil and the coal-fired power plant and the what Preston referred to as the princes of industry, that is the message that they're desperately trying to get out. You know, nothing to see here. This is not the sludge you were looking for.
Right.
But while they have gotten a lot of it's been tough to get it into the for-profit only media, David. The internet has done pretty good by it. There's a lot of stuff out there, and of course, it hit the New York Times. The story hit the New York Times yesterday with some facts and figures that are absolutely, you know, make your hair catch fire and run around the room naked. Urgent.
Mm. Well, one thing I would suggest is maybe as well as with the UCOL thing. With the blogging television channels that are out there, someone's going to have to give in to those enterprises and those industry and link up with one of those channels. I saw someone who's running for president in 2012, and there's another guy on there named Mike Mozart. I've been studying the behavior reaction in chat rooms for the past 2 weeks because I'm getting ready to gear up into that world of technology. And one of the things that's interesting is what Mike Mozart does is he just reviews weird toys. And he does live video reviews on blogtv.com. And he has so many people in his damn chat, and they just go ballistic, you know, when he shows a toy and just starts talking cutesy or whatever. And again, I think that there needs to be, I mean, if there's going to be a wave of activism and critical thinking regarding environmental issues, there needs to be a serious overhaul of branding. And I think like UCOL is a step in the right direction.
That's a great idea, and I will pass it along, David. But you wanted
to... And like I said, I think when you have something like that, you don't necessarily have videos on your channel just yet. I mean, like I said, buy the domain of UCOL before someone else does. They're not going to, but someone just might buy it up because they're domain buyers and they're just buying all the U whatever. I don't think they're going to buy it, but my point is that again, and also it's going to come to the top of the Google searches, especially if you have a video placed on YouTube. So people will stumble upon that as well. And for some reason, this is true, people will go with something familiar to YouTube to rather if you put a link for like CRMW.
Yeah.
They'll go to UCOL more than they will CRMW. I think, in my opinion.
There's a lot of possibility in that, David. And that's very well mentioned. You said you wanted to disagree in some regard.
Yeah, regarding the action and regarding corporations, I don't feel that these people are evil and CEOs. I've been talking to I'm around a lot of businessmen. I'm around some self-made millionaires. I'm around a lot of Republicans. I'm in that pocket. And one of my best friends is what I like to refer to him as an evil conservative. And what's funny is I don't want him to change because I think he's funny. And what he believes in. I mean, personally, that's my opinion. I guess I have an edge with people. I I don't get angry and I don't get mad when someone of someone's political persuasion, or I don't, it doesn't affect me, I guess. But I can understand why they think that way. And he always says to me, I can't help it. It's the way I see it. And it got me thinking about the CEOs, and it got me thinking about their families and all of that. And I don't, and not necessarily I have sympathy for these people at all. I just think more so of calling them evil, I look at it as a mental illness that is really, really destructive. And what I mean is, I don't know these people. So when I talk about them directly, and when you talk about them personally, I think that turns a lot of people off. And I would suggest to a lot of activists and progressives, it really does affect you. I know it firsthand because I've seen the emails that my dad forwards to me, and it's turning off a big block of people. And what people need to know, understand is the people that have chosen this road, I believe
have done it for a variety of motives, certainly.
Yeah, they've done it for a variety of motives, but really it comes down to mental illness. They've chosen this road. They believe it's the right road, and they're not willing to hear any other points of view. And they've completely isolated themselves. It's their religion in a way.
Corporatism is a sure. Is a religion, is a way of life, and it's also they also represent the chains of bondage, David.
Right.
Because if you're bright and shiny and smiling and you just got your little bachelor's of science or arts degree and you're out of college and you've got the student loan secret police gives you 6 months or something like that before they're on you like a duck on a June bug, and you have got to go to work and you have got to earn, and you will take the job that you are offered. And you will go to work in your cubicle every day and you will hope that you will rise into middle management or maybe senior management.
Right.
And you can't do that by not towing the company line.
Oh, but I'm talking about the I'm not just talking about the people on the road to the riches and the rising entrepreneurs and the people who want to be quote unquote mavericks. I'm talking about the people that are already there, the millionaires and the billionaires, the people that go shopping every single day. Every 5 hours.
So are they just lacking in introspection then, David?
I think what you're seeing, and this is what I believe, I think what you're seeing is you're seeing a person lost in the labyrinth of life. And we all have that moment where we're dazed. But imagine, I'm not asking anyone to have sympathy for any of these people. I'm just telling you, when you're instantly, you know what it's like? It's like this. People have sympathy. A lot of people in the police department don't have sympathy for gangsters or the gang members' lifestyles. But when you're raised in that environment, and your family, and you're raised in that environment, and you become accustomed to that culture, most people can't cross that path. There are very few people who could do it, you know?
There are a lot of people, well, I mean, just to use the obligatory movie reference, there are a lot of people who cannot escape the Matrix, David.
Yeah, they can't escape the Matrix once you cross the Rubicon. There is no ferry to go back for, they believe in their own mind, but there are some people who are able to make that jump. There are some people who are able to transition out of that. But my thing is that what you're seeing, the reason why I bring up the gangster lifestyle and all of that is because once you live in that type of world and once you become entrenched in it, it's really, really hard, it's really, really hard to get out of it.
Well, look, first of all, I've got to take issue with the idea of self-made. There is not a self-made individual in this world.
Oh, I hear what you're saying.
Secondly,
since you referenced the gangster lifestyle, or I guess gangsta, does it strike you as a little bit odd, or at least ironic, that that lifestyle is a caricature, a modeling on the lifestyles of the rich and famous?
Well, you know, this would be a good segue for the Office Space Scarface Ghetto Boy song, "Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster." Just
yeah, it would be.
Yeah,
but do you see what I'm saying? So what has happened is commercialized America has leveraged an otherwise desperate class and told them that the way that they get out of their desperation is to emulate them, but the only way to emulate them is by engaging in conduct that that class has also already predetermined to be criminal in nature.
I'll make an observation without judging our president-elect Obama. Now, for the Obama maniacs, I'm not criticizing him, I'm not scolding him, I'm just telling you this is the space he's in right now. Is it when you... I got flashes of Bush, Bob. I really did. When you are golfing, and everyone's on vacay, as they like to say.
Yeah.
When you're on vacay, and you have a environmental disaster, which page or which aide did not relay that message to you? Because if you
when you're golfing on vacation and somebody asks you about a genocide in progress in Gaza,
yeah.
And you say, well, if somebody was shooting rockets into my house at my daughter's, I'd do whatever I could to make it stop too. You know, that just shows a real shallowness of comprehension of the circumstances. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Does that work?
Yeah, yeah. But here's the thing where Obama could have had a win in this column. I would have taped the message. You know, the fact that he didn't do this shows me that we're dealing with someone with that. Just, if you guys know the song, just play it in your head. Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Because the fact that he didn't have a message and he didn't say anything, you know, it made me go, all right, this guy is not as in tune as his marketing and PR team said he was.
Well, the smart answer by a real human being who hasn't been corrupted by the American political process, and as a sidebar, I'll note that I think that they've already, you know, in line with that great old gag from Bill Hicks, they've already shown Barack Obama the 1963 footage, and he has already said, damn, that doesn't look like the Zapruder film. And the guy from the CIA said, that's the point. And Obama has said, where do I sign?
Yeah,
But a person of real character would have said, we are going to start sending humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip right now. None of our vessels will be armed, but we will get through. None of our vessels will be armed, but the first shot that is fired by the Israelis will be met with the sternest repercussions. And then you hold up a piece of paper and you say, this is an executive order that I will sign that cuts off every last penny to the state of Israel.
You know,
that's how you respond to that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think there is also the element of what a lot of people don't understand. When also it comes from people, and this is a serious thing. When you have somebody who comes from a lower class and a poor background, maybe it's all fictitious, and Obama came from a lawyer family or something, or they made it all up. But the background that was told to me, that was given to the press, when you come from that, you will have in the back of your minds, I am not going back to that, I'm going to do.
But he left that decades ago.
Oh, I know, but still, Bob, he couldn't go
back to that if he wanted to. The only could go back to would be to be a fabulously successful law professor at the University of Chicago.
But you have to see what I'm saying. It's psychological. When someone has that poor background. And you buy something and you have like a car and you get a dented or something, and you say, this is my car, I have to take care of it. It's that hypersensitive, and if you have that kind of background, you know what it's like? It's like Kanye West, he suffers from this. He doesn't want to go back to where he was living before, even though he's worth millions and millions and millions of dollars, but he'll always still have that in the back of his head.
Neither did Rick James, and neither did MC Hammer, but they did anyway.
Right. Rick James. Oh, you know who's a perfect example of that? Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, in the documentary, I love this story.
Sure.
He doesn't have a manager.
But let me back up just a minute, David, because I got to roll onto another call in a second.
Okay.
Let me just back up for a second and suggest that what Gaza needs is something that we already know we can do. We need a Berlin airlift for Gaza because the situation is the same. You had a post-war Berlin that the Soviets decided they were going to choke to death because, you know, West Berlin was surrounded on all sides by the Soviet zone of what became East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran planes in night and day in the single most heroic act, probably, of American humanitarianism that has ever taken place, until we made it impossible for the Soviets to destroy and choke to death West Berlin.
Mm.
Gaza is West Berlin. If we had any morality in our government whatsoever, we would begin yesterday a Berlin airlift for Gaza.
I hear what you're saying, Bob.
Instead, poor Cynthia McKinney, in a lone boat, gets rammed by the Israeli Navy.
I see what you're saying. Before I close out, I just wanted to say that John Fox, you are a psychic, and I can't say anything, but I'll give you this hint, John. There will be chocolate in D.C. And I know this for a fact. I know this for a fact because my friend is the drummer in the All-Stars.
Whoa.
He's working on the arrangement right now.
No.
Yes. He's working on the arrangement right now. In fact, he's had a whirlwind of a year. Check this out.
You mean on that day somewhere in Washington D.C. live? Those opening strains are going to come out, and somebody's going to say, "What's happening, CC?"
No, you can't give it away.
I won't go any further.
I'm obligated. It's contractual. You can't say it. He did. If you go to his website, I'll send you a link to it so you can see the update that he does on his website on it. So you can see I'm not gooning on you or just I pulled it out of my ass. But this guy has had a whirlwind of a year. He's been the drummer for the P-Funk All-Stars for about, I'd say he's going to go on his second year. He's probably going to be there till Clinton gets picked up by the mothership. He got to meet, Grace Jones. He got to work with George Clinton and Sly Stone and Al DeBarge. And he got to meet with, D'Angelo.
I'm glad somebody got more out of 2008 than I did.
Yeah.
And most of us
did. Here's the crazy part about it. He's gonna be, we have a direct link, Bob. We have a direct link, people, to the Bob Cheadle Miles movie, which is gonna be phenomenal. You got Don Cheadle playing Miles. I don't care how the movie turns out. The music's going to be awesome.
It can't help but be.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe we can get some of your tickets.
Well, that's a little, you ain't saying nothing, but, and, yeah, right. But that's a heck of a little New Year's Eve blast. David, I hope you have a safe and happy New Year's Day, and we will talk soon.
Let me tell you something. This arrangement, I know this guy, he's an amazing musician. It's going to be kick ass because he has an incredible mind just for music, and wait till you hear it. You're gonna be impressed how he comes at it and his angle.
Cool.
So Bob, I think we have we can call John Fox's new show. We can subtitle it "Psyched Up." John Fox, all psyched up.
Call me now. I'll read your cards.
Smile. a mile, like 10 miles away. He saw that coming 10 miles away. Amazing.
I love it. David, take care.
All right, later.
Bye now.
Bye.
And let's keep it cooking. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Bob. It's Maura. How are you?
Maura. Oh, my goodness. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty strong tonight, so I just wanted to wish you and Agnes and the whole Horn family a very happy New Year.
Oh, bless your heart and the same thing to you.
And I just want everybody at the Horn to know how special I think you all are. You have a very, very deep place in my heart, all of you.
Oh, that tickles me to no end. I'm sort of speechless. I see correspondence and we correspond and everything, but I've never heard from you and I'm just kind of blown away. This is a real treat and a real gift. I really appreciate it.
It is for me too, Bob. And I totally enjoy every minute of the Horn and our correspondence, and it gives me a lift in life.
You know what?
That's a big gift to someone.
Well, that's justification for doing what we do.
You don't know how great you guys are. All the family and the Horn, fabulous.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I trust you're well this New Year's Eve?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Good, good.
And looking forward to the new year and a new president.
Oh, here. Anything's got to be better. And I know we ask some questions and we make some pointed criticisms, but we have to keep some level of perspective. Anything has got to be better, Maura.
There's no way it could be worse. There is no way. I've been waiting for that bastard to get out of that White House for 8 years. Excuse my French.
No, that's mild compared to what I would let loose with if I wasn't trying to keep an eye out for all the mommies and daddies who don't want to explain the fun words tonight. But you know,
I'd also like to have an appeal to all the listeners to try and put aside a couple of bucks a month to help out the Horn to stay in business. I mean, this is a very, very special place for all of us. It's desperately needed. And we have to let it live. So, folks, even if you only have $2, please send it in.
Okay? It all goes toward making it keep happening. And
absolutely, absolutely. So, folks, everybody have a very happy New Year, and I hope it's healthy and prosperous for everyone.
Maura, I am honored. Truly, I am honored to hear from you. And
thank you, Bob.
Just to no end, a very happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
And
talk
take
to you
care.
Guys soon.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I've shared notes with you from Maura in the past. She's calling from New Jersey. And we've never spoken before, and I am touched to the very core of my being to hear from her. And that's the word treat is the only thing that comes to mind. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, you said light up the phones, and, you know, I never say no to an invitation.
Absolutely not.
No, I was just listening to you talking about the Berlin Airlift idea, which I think is a great idea. The interesting thing, though, I think about the Berlin Airlift was that it wasn't a humanitarian effort by the people who set it up, only by the people who carried it out.
Here. It was political and it was strategic.
Propaganda. It was propaganda, basically. The people who actually physically did it, yes, they were being humanitarians. But that's not why it was set up and that's not why it was enabled. But anyway, that's the kind of... Isn't it really unfortunate that the world forces you to think like that?
Yeah, it is.
Hopefully it's going to be a better one
it's a little slice of misery to realize that we are made to think like that, and it harkens back to what Preston and I were talking about the negative power of despair.
Mhm.
But they're not delivering anything else in Gaza, but if not, they're delivering despair by the helicopter load.
I was going to say they're delivering high explosives quite nicely. You know, it's just...
Although I don't, you know, nicely is somehow oxymoronic in that context, but yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. You know, and like the language that gets used that, you know, you were talking earlier, like targeting civilians. The rockets that they're firing aren't targeted in any way, shape, or form. They're more a form of a very nasty protest, I think. I mean, they're not targeted at anything. They're just set off. You know, it's a bit like in England, you know, on Guy Fawkes Night, put the rocket in the bottle and light the blue touch paper and stand well back. It's a bit like that, really, isn't it?
With more lethal consequences, certainly.
Yeah, but not within
the proportion of what's been what has been delivered delivered back to them.
Yeah.
And frankly, look, let's get one thing straight, Dave. And I'm not lecturing you. This is more. When I say let's get one thing straight, I'm talking in terms of just the framing and the ideas behind these things. There's no Gaza army, okay? There's no Gaza air force. There's no Gaza navy. There's no Gaza infantry. There's no Gaza the tank brigade, if that's the right word. All there are is a little tiny sliver of land crowded with human beings who have been pushed to the absolute last molecule of the apex of despair. And when you, and it's not like it was a Sunday trip for them. It's where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And when you live that way, and the rocket goes into the apartment building, and the little dead boy comes out. That little dead boy is your entire community.
Mm-hmm.
And it is being repeated time after time after time after time. And the Israeli government has the unmitigated gall to stand there and face the world and say, well, if they'd only stop being the way they are.
Yeah, if they'd only stop being the way they are, we could have stolen their land much more efficiently.
And there's nothing worth having in Gaza.
Well, it's...
I mean, just from...
What the hell are all the settlers doing then? If there's nothing in there that's worth having, why do the settlers want it?
Because the settlers have a deep-seated genocidal urge...
For ethnic cleansing, yeah.
I hate that phrase, Dave. You know.
I hate it for what it is.
I hate it for the pretty. No, I'm staying with genocide.
Yep, genocide's perfect.
I mean, because you know, I read last night on the show you were here.
Mm-hmm. I'm here quite regularly these days.
I went to my King James version of the. Really, I think the word holy ought to be taken off that phrase, Bible. And, you know, I thumbed my way over to Deuteronomy, and I found that section where, you know, and lo, I did deliver them unto thee, and we did kill everything that moved, crept, flew, or crawled, and God did give unto us that land. Well, see, what I read, you can replace the word Gaza with whether it's Canaanites or, you know, any of that garbage.
Nothing new under the sun.
And it doesn't change the meaning.
No. No.
Turn you...
Yeah, I don't go near that book. When I touch it, it burns my fingers, so I keep away from that book these days.
Turn you and take your journey and go to the Mount of the Amorites and all the places nigh thereunto. In the plain, in the hills, and in the vale. Thin pages, sorry, it's kind of a pain in the butt. South and by the sea, to the land of Canaanites, and unto Lebanon, and unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, if you follow that on a map, that's a bunch of land. That's Syria, and Jordan, and Iraq, and Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Behold, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. to give unto them and to their seed after them.
Well, yeah, God gave him a deed. I mean, you know.
You see, this has always been a problem. If you look at any war, everybody's got God on their side. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's like that phrase we ran across, I think it was before you found the horn, Dave. We used to do a show, John Fox and Peter Godbold and I, called The Horn Section.
Yeah, before.
And we found this bumper sticker that said, if your God hates all the things you do, that's a pretty good indication he's not real. And lo and behold, that's what happens. You want to kill somebody? Well, just say God told you. It's not like anybody can find God. Hey, did you really say that to them? Oh, no, I never said that. That's not going to happen. It's like the preacher who took up the collection. And they said, how do you deal with the collection plate every Sunday, brother? And the preacher said, well, I go outside after church, and I take all the collections. And I look up at the sky, and I say, God, I'm going to throw all of this up in the air. You keep what you want, and what falls to earth is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everything always falls to earth, doesn't it? Gravity being gravity.
What's that warping of the space-time continuum, I think? But, you know.
So,
I find this part of the year kind of bizarre. For various reasons, like, you know, the New Year thing. I mean, yeah, it's a good excuse. Well, it used to be a good excuse to go out and get drunk. I'm a bit old for that these days.
Well, that's why we call it amateur night.
Yeah, but I don't know. I just find now that I'm looking at the next, well, particularly this year, right?
Well, see, I need
the nine with a certain amount of trepidation, shall we say.
I look at every day that way, doing what I do, yeah. Dave. There are nights that I close the show and leave the studio, and I feel like I need to creep back into the studio the next morning just to see what sort of hell on earth has been unleashed in my absence. Because I don't trust anybody not to unleash that hell anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, if this is one of those moments of Bob's overbearing, overarching, monumental ego. But if it was up to me and somebody just put me in charge, New Year's would not happen on December 31st. I mean, if we're going to have one of these, let's at least let it happen. Let's pick a date.
50% chance of a nice day.
Yeah. Well, let's pick a day. Let's pick a day when the entire world that'll be going by the calendar has a chance at a nice day. Let's pick it so that it would be the.
The spring or autumn.
Early spring or early autumn, depending on which hemisphere you're in.
Yeah, exactly. So we need an equinox celebration, sod all these solstices.
Well, and then you got to rearrange all the Christian holidays. Nah, it's just not going to work, Dave. Sorry.
Well, why do we have to have Christian holidays? What about the people who aren't Christian? You know, rearrange them, sod it.
Yeah, but...
Get it?
But then Pope Benny can't come out in his Santa suit and declare that the gays cause global warming.
Well, I can't take someone seriously who spends most of his life in fancy dress. I'm sorry.
Oh, I can take that person seriously. Dear Lord, I mean, anybody who's ever seen a movie with Divine, how do you not take Divine seriously? RuPaul seems to be serious about it. But it's spending your life in fancy dress, figuring out ways to keep a continent on fire with HIV, and telling people that no, that guy I can't take seriously.
I can't take anybody who heads up any of the major religions seriously.
Well, I highly recommend Religious to you when you get the opportunity. There's an interview
I've seen a few clips.
There's much more to it. There's a scene there, and I'm not going to give anything away, but there's a scene there with the Vatican historian, who's Father John somebody or another, who is apparently beyond the reach of the Iron Fist at this point in his life. And they're just standing in Vatican Square, Bill Maher and this Vatican historian, and the guy just lays it out. And you've got this idea that while the camera's on Father John, Bill Maher's off camera with his mouth hanging open catching flies. And it's a pretty stunning moment. Well, when the guy who's in the Church of Marijuana in Amsterdam's hair catches on fire from the candles, but never mind.
One of my sillier pastimes when I now have a beard, as you know.
Right.
But when I was younger, one of my sillier pastimes was fire eating, and I set fire to my hair a couple of times. I used to claim to be the only stilt walking, juggling, fire eating sign painter in town.
Well, you know, if you're doing that, you've certainly carved a niche.
that was my claim to fame many years back.
I don't know why you ever would have left the profession.
Well, computers took over the sign business.
Ah, true. and it's hard to
safety kind of killed the fire eating idea.
And it's hard to hold up a PC on stilts.
Yeah, exactly. So that just leaves juggling, and if you drop a computer, it makes a hell of a mess.
Well, that's true too. But do you still keep the reflexes warm? Do you juggle when you find yourself in the grocery store? Do you just pick up three lemons and have at it?
It's funny. There was one day I was walking through, and I just got three lemons, and one of the women who works there, and I live just over the way, so I'm always over in there. So I kind of joke with people, just the way I am. And then she was walking up, and she had a couple of lemons. I said, "Oh, you need three," and I started to juggle. And she went and got another one, and we both stood there in the supermarket juggling.
That's a beautiful thing. Now, see, Ferg got a juggling set, I guess, last Christmas, and took it. You know, he takes learning things very seriously, and he worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And now I can't take him into the grocery store through the produce aisle without keeping a hawk's eye on him. Stop it! Stop it! Stop! I don't need lemons today, Ferg. I'll have to buy the lemons once you drop them on the floor. Put the lemons back. So far, he has
of kerosene and sticks with wicks on the end. Then
I'm so glad he's not listening now. Because this would be one of those Dave, you're not helping moments.
Yeah. I just kind of ran away with it there a little bit without thinking about that one. And I've promised my son that when he's 18, because my kids have never seen me without a beard, but I promised my son when he's 18, I'll shave my beard off and teach him to eat fire. So there you go.
Well, then, you got a
little 3 years to go. I'm okay.
Yeah, maybe he'll forget.
Nope.
No, because you added in the fire eating part. The shave my beard part, a kid will forget.
Yeah.
The fire-eating part, no, you did yourself in with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Dave, I assume it's freezing cold where you are.
I think we got, with the wind chill, I think we got about minus 24 at the moment.
Ouch.
We got snow overnight, but not too much, but it's pretty damn cool out there.
We had a nice skiff today. It was very pleasant yesterday, but, you know, about 41 degrees at the height of the day. Fahrenheit.
I was going to say Fahrenheit. Mind you, a couple of days, a few days ago, it was 16 degrees Canadian at 2 a.m., which is ridiculous. You know, it's like 60 degrees, 62 degrees at 2 a.m. And by 2 p.m. that day, it was minus 4.
You know, good God.
20 degrees.
Swing.
12
yeah.
hours. And it's been like all winter. It's all over the damn place this year.
Well, welcome to that. You'll be seeing more of that.
Oh, no. Like this year, we've got La Nina, which cools everything down. And the sun's at its lowest level of activity since anyone's really been watching closely. But we're going to ramp up both of them in the next 5 years. And given this year is still up there with some of the warmer ones globally averaged, it's not going to be long before the North Pole is... Welcome to the swim.
Yeah.
You know, and it's happening so fast now.
Well, yeah, give it 20 or 25 years and there'll be billboards up. You know, spend your summer vacation in sunny Thunder Bay on our sandy beaches.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Oh, you can see it happening.
I know. Well, Dave, I hope you have a good New Year's Eve. Stay away from the roads. Of course, it is amateur night. I love that phrase.
No, I'm home now. I'm just working on my, I do my 3D modeling thing for fun, and I'm just working on my Happy New Year image. So you will receive that at some point later, probably.
Wonderful. I'll be looking for it. Dave, take care and Happy New Year, and let's make 2009 a better one.
Who's out there listening?
All right. Take care, Dave. Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from sunny Ontario, our buddy Dave. Hi, welcome to the program.
Oh, good evening, Bob.
Oh, hey, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Going to try to stay up for the New Year, so I don't know if I'm going to make it or not. It's been a long day. We've had company. I just got to call you in at the last minute. We've had company till just a few minutes. And I'm going to wish all you, your friends and our friends and the friends of people, I hope they have a lot better New Year's than what this last has been. And I'm sure we will with get rid of George Bush.
That's a start.
That's a good lick in the right direction. And I really appreciate what you're doing with the station. And just wish everybody a Happy New Year. That's what I call for.
All right. Well, Ed, I thank you very kindly. And I'll put you back on hold.
That'd be great.
All right. Happy New Year to you and all of yours, Ed.
All right. Thank you.
Stand by now. Well, all quiet on the phone lines. About 9 minutes before the ordinary end of the program. And I promised last night that I was going to go delve into a story, maybe you've seen it, maybe you haven't, that I had been leaving lay for a little bit because I wanted to find the right time to bring it your way. It's a newspaper story out of Tuz Kermatu, Iraq. And it was published in the Washington Post by Amit R. Paley. Headline says, "For Kurdish girls, a painful ancient ritual." And it has to do with female circumcision. And it is a sickening story, and it is accompanied by a series of several equally sickening photographs. Female circumcision. As practiced, now I told you that the dateline is Iraq. This isn't the Sunni Triangle. This isn't the Shiite South near Basra. Tuz Kermatu is in that bastion of burgeoning democracy, we have been told, is Kurdistan, the Kurdish North that is semi-autonomous and has been since the end of Bush War I. The story chronicles the practice, which is so horrifying in its own right as to make it difficult for me to talk about it. And I'm just squeamish enough. Sorry, I'm not fully enlightened yet. I'll tell you when the apple falls out of the bow tree, okay? I'm just unenlightened enough to be very, very uncomfortable with this topic. But it's prayer meeting. And the reason that I saved this story for prayer meeting in the midst of the hell and the horror that is Gaza, some several hundred miles to the west and south, is because of a couple of quotes in this story. It is the story of Shilan Anwar Omer, who is 7 years old. And Kurdish. The newspaper story relates that she went running joyfully into the house of a neighbor, grinning from ear to ear, because her mother had told her that she was going to a party. The minute she gets through the door, an old iron door is slammed behind her. and they tell her to undress. Her mother and another woman. They hold her on the ground and perform what can only be described as one of the most barbaric rituals known to humankind on this 7-year-old girl, ensuring the likelihood that she will never in her adult life experience much of anything approaching sexual pleasure. So that when she is sold off to some husband, she will be such that she treats sexual intercourse as a perfunctory act not to be enjoyed and strictly for purposes of the gratification of her husband or whomever he may give her to. And procreation. Her mother is Aisha Hamid, and she is 30 years old. They live about 100 miles north of Baghdad. She is quoted in the story as saying, "This is the practice of the Kurdish people for as long as anyone can remember. We don't know why we do it, but we will never stop, because Islam and our elders require it." For you see, if young Shilan Anwar Omer grows to adulthood and has an intact functioning clitoris, no one will eat food delivered from her hands. Remember the phrase, remember the quote, "This is the practice of the Kurdish people for as long as anyone can remember. We don't know why we do it, but we will never stop, because Islam and our elders require it." This is the torment of little children. This is the torment of little girls. Oddly enough, this practice exists, as I said, not in Arabic areas of Islam, but rather in Africa, in some parts of Asia, and among the Kurdish people, our buddies. I have read and heard where Muslim peoples will tell you point blank, and it was told to me straightforward by a Pakistani man, a physician, that while there is a great deal of equality bruited about in Islam, that the Arabic peoples look down on Muslims of other ethnicities. I don't know if that is the reason why this practice mercifully doesn't exist in the lives of women who are otherwise reduced to nothing more than human bondage. You know, traditional family values, marriage. But I do know that there are some things in this world that are intolerable within the realm of anything that most of us would define as civilized. I'm going to run a few minutes over tonight. Genital mutilation. It's not tattooing. It's not even the old Indian practice of the manhood ritual of hoisting a man via bird claws in his pectorals. Nope. It is something that forever changes a human being's ability to participate in, appreciate, and perhaps even enjoy the full panoply of what it means to be a human living on this planet. A while back, you know, I started the program with a posting from our good friend Eugene Finnerman. And a while back, he had a post about the Indian subcontinental practice of suti, whereby a widowed wife would immolate herself along with the being cremated corpse of her dead husband. And in the course of the posting, Eugene noted that throughout Britain's association, occupation, and reduction and pillaging of India, great harms had been done, great evils wrought, but that they got it right when they outlawed the practice of women being required to immolate themselves, burn themselves to death alive over the cold corpse of their husbands. Some similar thing needs to be done here. Newsflash, it won't. The statistics in this article are sickening. The woman who made $3.50 per clitoris on the day that the story was written did 7 girls in that room where the party was supposed to take place and said that she had done something on the order of, I forget exactly what it was. She'd been the midwife, so called, was 40 years old and had been doing it since she was 20 years old. A German non-governmental organization called WADI did a study of women in more than 300 Kurdish villages and found that 62% of the women had 62% had this horror inflicted upon them. And while this so-called ritual was being done, the mother whispered, "It's all right, it's all right," into the 7-year-old's ear. And the so-called midwife, who had done this to 30 girls a year for 20 years, mumbled some prayer as she slathered ashes on the child's genitals to staunch the bleeding. The little girl herself asked about it. They asked her whether it was worth it to have the procedure, the butchery, in order that her friends and neighbors would be comfortable eating food given from her hands. And 7-year-olds have a way of telling truths that sometimes the elders and God are apparently unable to comprehend. Because she replied, "I would do anything not to have this pain, even if it meant they would not eat from my hands. I just wish that I could be the way I was before the procedure." Meanwhile, one of the legislators for the region.